It's Tony Martin and Tony Wilson still attempting and often failing to fill the enormous gill-shaped shoes that sit beneath this desk regularly. Derek will be back on Monday, but in the meantime, you've got us. What are we talking about? Books, Tony. We haven't really got into the nerdish world of books during our tenure here.
We haven't, and we're both authors, so we're interested in them.
That's
but the question is, will they be with us forever and a day? According to some, they are vital and part of our cultural landscape. According to others, we'll just get a Kindle, download from the net, hardly need one.
Kindle, that's right. You'll just be able to burn all your books and just have one tiny electronic device on your coffee table. I don't think that's going to take off, so tonight we're going to have a celebration of books and all that they stand for. Get your nerd hats on. It's all coming up after the news.
Tony Martin and Tony Wilson on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
And good evening to you. It's the final edition of Gill or No Gill. Tonight, no Gill. Tony and Tony sitting in the chairs. Derek will be back on Monday, tomorrow night. Some sort of football going on, is that right?
Yes, people may be wondering what that is, but then you're not looking hard enough for football because the VFL Grand Final is on tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. You said to me a couple of nights ago that you thought the VFL had been abolished.
and that's not the case.
Well, it no longer is the top level game in this state. It's the second tier competition, the statewide competition that involves such powerhouses as North Ballarat, who I believe are in the grand final tomorrow night.
Right, so it's like the Betamax, is that what you're saying?
Well, it's like the Betamax as it was getting swamped, in the sense that it does exist. Does the Betamax even exist anymore? Can you rent a Betamax anywhere in Victoria?
I'm sure there'd be a video shop somewhere that still has a Beta Grotto down the back. Remember that sort of sad little area?
I taped all of Blackadder onto Beta.
Did you?
So I've got that.
That was illegal, I'll have you know.
I also taped the 1989 Grand Final onto Beta. So some of these things that I really planned on keeping forever and have, I've got in the unplayable Beta format because I no longer have a recorder.
I love the way we've segued from football to more nerdish issues, because tonight we are going to have some football talk, aren't we? Sam Pang's going to be here.
Absolutely. He had a stint down at Collingwood, now hosting ADBC. It may segue quickly into history if you have anything to do with it. But he's certainly a football font.
But I want to talk about books because it's our last show and we haven't really talked books, and we love them.
We do.
They're on the way out, we're told. The Kindle's on its way in. I know Guy Rundle penned a very controversial article a couple of weekends back. Book import laws are madness, based on delusion.
Well, he's, I guess he's been a champion and a bit of a darling of what the right-wingers would describe as the loony left.
Right, right.
And, you know, he's been a writer for Max Gillies and there's been, people would expect Guy Rundle to be against against parallel importation of books. Now, I guess we have to quickly talk about what parallel importation is.
Yes. Can you explain that in simple terms that even I can understand, Tony Wilson?
In 1991, they introduced a rule that it's called the 30-day rule.
Right.
Every publisher in Australia has 30 days to nab a title that's been published elsewhere in the world, and then they will be able to become, to buy up those rights, and they will become the publisher of that title in Australia. Now, why that's important is that some small publishers, and in particular I'm thinking of places like Scribe and Text Publishing, have become relative powerhouses here in the local industry because they've managed to fund themselves on the back of these international titles. So they spot a great book like I'm Not Afraid by Amarinti. That's a textbook, a fantastic book.
Yep.
They spot that, and that will sell quite well amongst the book club types and make a buck for a medium-sized publisher. And then that money can be funneled back into the writing industry here in Australia. So, for example, I'm a published author with Text. They may not have offered me an advance and an opportunity to get published if they weren't making good dollars through exploiting this 30-day rule where they can nab a title, an international title, and make it their own.
Okay, so that's the 30-day rule. Then you've got territorial copyright. Explain what that is, Tony, if you can.
Territorial copyright is... Oh, I'm not sure I can.
Really?
That's parallel importation. Territorial copyright is... Well, how do you understand it?
Well, obviously, if you publish something here, you've got territorial copyright.
For it in Australia.
Yeah, that's right.
In that form.
Hmm.
Yeah, well, I guess that's... That's looking at protecting an author's rights to have work designed for this market. Like, for example, when you write a book that is intended for the whole world, I haven't started well. Books get re-edited in other markets so that a reference to, for example, your book was called Lolly Scramble.
That might be...
That makes no sense to even people here in Australia. Well done, Tone.
That might be titled Candy Scramble.
That might be called Candy Scramble in the United States. Now, but you might really not want your book to be called Candy Scramble when it hits the Australian market. But if these rules are relaxed so that it's a free market, it's open slather... Then if there are leftover copies of Candy Scramble in America, they will be shipped here to Australia. And you may find that Lolly Scramble, which you've printed through your Australian publisher here and edited for an Australian market, you might find that there's a competing and cheaper form of Lolly Scramble in Candy Scramble sitting there right next to it on the shelf.
You notice this. There are discount bookshops around Melbourne where you'll find the American... edition of a Tim Winton title, for example.
Exactly.
And if you turn it on its side, it's got like someone's gone it with a bit of felt pen, so that's slightly damaged in some way. So you can get it for like $9.95.
And when there's a remainder, usually the author has given up almost all of his or her royalty on that book. So you may still have quite a thriving print run here in Australia of Lolly Scramble, but you might be making 2 cents a book on Candy Scramble.
Yeah.
Suddenly, the market here is swamped with Candy Scramble and you're no longer making a living out of writing.
Now, the Productivity Commission, their report that's been tabled, has it?
They have tabled a report. I think it came out in July. And basically, it was that books are going to be cheaper if we get rid of these rules.
Right.
And so, therefore, we're going to get rid of them over the next 3 years. There's going to be a three-year... I guess what's it called, a grace period. So the current 30-day rule will survive for 3 more years, but then bang, no parallel importation, free market, any leftover books in the States can come here. There's no opportunity, much less opportunity for small publishers here to buy up rights to international titles.
Now, who is Henry Rosenblum? Explain who he is.
He's a publisher at Scribe Publications. Scribe Publisher.
Now, he's written a lot about this on the internet, and he's got some very interesting things to say. The commission itself has previously acknowledged that the average price gap between local and overseas English language editions is eliminated if exchange rates of 41 cents in the pound, 67 cents in the US dollar are used, which is very close to the average of the last 10 years. In its most recent study for the period July 2008 to May 2009, it finds that in recommended retail price terms, the price of the cheapest available editions of titles in Australia is on average 13% higher than the lowest cost UK edition and 27% higher than the US lowest cost edition.
So he is saying that on average, we do have more expensive books in a pure dollar sense, that seems to be what the Productivity Commission have ended up deciding. They're cheaper overseas, so we're going to allow consumers to have a crack at those overseas prices. But what Rosenblum goes on to say is that the freight cost is too tricky to calculate for the purposes of this study.
The Commission has not included the cost of overseas freight.
And so books apparently arrive here invisibly. So the price that they are stated at on these big internet sites, which look so cheap to us, as anyone who has had, like yourself, Tony Martin, who is obsessed with almost in the way some people follow the stock market, you follow DVD prices on those big online supermarkets.
I do.
if, as we all know, it's sometimes a bit of a surprise when you finally get to check out and find and discover that the cost of getting your thing here to Australia actually pushes it up or getting close to what you might have paid here.
When you get to the final click of the button, you suddenly discover it's $20 more than you thought it was going to be. What about the GST? How is that a factor?
Well, Henry Rosenblum at Scribe has also said that that when you buy something online or one of those international prices doesn't include a GST. Of course, some jurisdictions do have their own goods and services tax, or VAT, I think some of them are called, but some don't. And that one way that if the government is so committed to the idea of cheaper books, it certainly was a very big argument at the time the GST came in, that if we're going to exempt food, are books culturally important enough to be exempt from GST? And you could just strip the GST from books, and suddenly they would plunge down into a very competitive price bracket.
Well, in conclusion, Mr. Rosenblum says in regards to the Commission's recommendations, a pathetic assertion that some of the time, in some circumstances, some booksellers might be able to import cheaper books and to achieve this highly conditional benefit argued on specious grounds, maintains Mr. Rosenblum, it has recommended a radical change that would devastate the publishing industry and its authors, and along with it, an important component of Australian life and culture.
And it is worth looking at how Australian publishers have boomed in the last 20 years under this 30-day rule. It really has... But people have exercised their rights, publishers have exercised their rights. And in comparison to other Australian cultural industries, like the film industry, for example, the publishing industry is going very well, and Australian authors have gone very well. And when you think of the prominence of Australian authors compared to, for example, Australian filmmakers, there's no doubt that something has been working quite well in this industry, and yet we want to change this. We want to go the way of New Zealand, which is pretty much the only country on earth that has allowed parallel importation. The United States, they protect their local book market. The United Kingdom have something close to the 30-day rule in order to protect the UK authors and publishers. So really, we're going out on quite a radical and Henry Rosenblum says neoliberal style of limb.
Well, you know, we mentioned Guy Rundle at the beginning. His assertion is forget about all this because publishers will put up a fight over the next two decades, says Guy, but will largely cease to exist in their current form. In online environments, authors don't need publishers at all. When the online book becomes the norm, the whole idea of publishing as an activity tends to dissolve altogether. Now, is that where we're headed? Online books? Kindles? Have you got yourself a Kindle?
Well, it feels like there's about 8 Kindles in the country at the moment.
Yeah.
So it hardly, even though Guy Rundle may be right that there's going to be an online explosion, and certainly he's had a bit of luck online recently. His writing on the US election was just sensational on the crikey.com.au website.
Sorry, I should have said electronic reader, not what I said before. Pardon me.
Is that a brand, is it?
Apparently it is. Sorry about that. But, you know, in all of this talk, what I think is being left out is the simple beauty, the simple majesty, the simple poetry of reading, Tony. That's what we want to talk about, the books themselves.
The physical artifact. And, you know, I was saying that if these things that aren't called that name, we called them before, but are electronic readers, will you be able to prop up your child's cot when he or she has a cold?
A wonky coffee table.
In order to allow, you know, the downward flow of snot. Books are so important for that.
There's a fantastic essay on this subject by the late John Updike called A Case for Books. It's the best bit of writing I've ever read on the subject of the physical book versus the electronic reader. That's available in his book, his fine book called Due Considerations. I think we want people to call us up and say, what are you reading?
It's a very, you're welcome to give views on, on this thorny little issue, which can get a little technical, I guess. So it may be that you just want to talk about a moment you've had with a book. You may just want to give a book recommendation. We may just transform ourselves into the first Tuesday book club.
We may just
Tony
do
Martin.
That. I'm going to frock up right now. The number to call is 1-300-222-774. Give us a call. Talk about books. And in the meantime, here's XTC with The Man Who Murdered Love. That's XTC, The Man Who Murdered Love, from I think it was their last album, Wasp Star. Now, Tony Wilson and myself, Tony Martin, filling in for Derek Gill tonight. Final night of us doing this. We're talking books. Tony's made a pretty good fist of explaining the parallel importation controversy.
And then I had a genuine blackout on what territorial copyright was until I think we sort of got there with that as well.
I was very unhelpful.
So you're very welcome to talk that with us. Do you think that parallel importation should be allowed, or are you really chasing the cheaper books? Do you think that the Coalition for Cheaper Books have a really good point that we pay too much here in Australia?
I know Bob Carr's on board, but he's also on the board of Dimmicks, is he not? Yeah. Or sorry, a bookshop that I shouldn't mention, but I think that's important to know when he speaks.
I think that's right.
That he's representing a large chain of bookstores.
You might just want to talk a reading moment. What are you reading at the moment, Tony?
Well, I just wanted to mention that I am one of these people who gets online and orders books from overseas that I think aren't going to come out here. A couple of books we've talked about this week, King Dork by Frank Portman, finally, about a year after it was released overseas, came out here, and I recommended a lot of people to buy that. And book I've been talking about, Being Hal Ashby, the first biography of filmmaker Hal Ashby. There's no sign of that coming out here. So I'm one of these people who, if it's out here, I'll buy the local edition. But there's a hilarious novel I've been reading called How I Became a Famous Novelist by Steve Healy. I doubt whether that will be released here in the near future. Paul Rudnick, the very amusing humour writer, he has a new book out called I Shudder. There's no sign of that coming out here. So I tend to get online and order those. And you see, like, the hardcover edition, you go, well, that's pretty good value. But like you say, once the postage is added and the exchange rate is factored in, it comes to pretty much the same price, I would have thought, that it's going to be when it's released here.
And it's interesting to note that the Productivity Commission and now the government that now has to act on the report, and the recommendation is to get rid of, to allow parallel importation. It's a sweet spot for the purchaser who looks online, because that Australian dollar is kicking goals at 87 cents. Tony Martin did a bit of research before the show. It was hard to almost get him in the studio. He was just off with credit card in hand to go on a binge.
A backlist of DVDs, but Francis from Albert Park is online. You've got something to contribute, Francis?
Guys, I hope I have.
Yeah.
First thing about authors and parallel imports, like, I think it's just within the power of the authors. They're just small businessmen like everybody else. They should be able to negotiate with the publishers what the rights are, and that should include stopping overseas publishers for dumping books back into the market here if they have a separate agreement here. And I've never understood why an author, I mean, they're artistic and that, but they're still business people. They've got to be able to make a living. Why don't just do that?
How would you go negotiating with your publisher, Tony?
Not very well, but the publisher, you might be right, Francis, that a publisher or an agent would be working hard to get that sort of clause into any overseas rights deal that you aren't allowed to dub stock in Australia. But it'd be interesting to know that if the government is making this policy that they want parallel importation to happen, what happens if there's individual contracts keep being made that are absolutely against the spirit of this policy?
For you to do that, though, as an author, you don't have to allow a publisher in the United States to then dump remnants back into Australia. And, I mean, it's a simple solution, quite frankly. It's within the author's powers, and it's always astounded me that they don't do that.
Although, if say, Penguin US offered me a deal and no other publisher in America were offering me a deal, and they said, you know, we can really make your career and make your fortune, it's unlikely that I would stand up and say, if they said a prerequisite of the deal was that we have the right to move this into any jurisdiction or any territory that we want, you really can't fight against that. You would take the deal and cop it here, I guess.
Of course, but that's a commercial decision you make. You can't then, I had to use the word, but you can't screw the Australian public just because you want to make some money on a US deal and then make a bit more money in Australia. I mean, I just see it's straight business decisions. It's commercial.
Well, I think you've got to get your negotiating hat on there, Tony. Thank you, Francis. Frank from South Kingsville, have you got a book recommendation for us?
Look, I can understand, like, for example, parallel importing electronic books for these books you find in airport terminals.
Yep.
Look, that's a separate matter. But what about technical, books on highly specialised technical subjects? For example, there's a book that that interests me because I've got an interest in naval history called Big Gun Monitors. It's a specific detailed research book on the history of a particular class of ship used by the Royal Navy in both wars. For, you know, photographs, technical details, drawings. Now, it's the sort of book that requires the person buying it to be interested in such an esoteric subject. And secondly, it's a sort of book that you can't just sort of read on a wintry afternoon. It would take months and months of heavy reading. And that sort of book, if it was only available on one of these electronic formatting things, I wouldn't bother.
No.
But it's the sort of book I want on my shelf so that I can pull down and say, look, I've got a couple of hours to spare, I'll read a couple of pages and put it back under the shelf and gradually get through it over a couple of months.
I think that's right. Those very big technical books, they're much nicer with big glossy pages and diagrams, and I think it would send you insane within about 20 minutes to be staring at a little computer screen trying to make out the dimensions of the left gun on the right foreship.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the illustration for, you know, the photos reproduce very well in these.
Yeah, for example, this book I mentioned, the illustrations is detailed designs of detailed drawings of the designs of the turrets, the mechanism of how the guns work, the layouts of the ship.
Yes.
The thing is that it's the sort of book that, as I said, one, it requires the person to be interested in such an esoteric subject, and two, it requires the person to read it over many, many months. And I think, to be quite honest, these electronic book thingies would be perhaps more suited toward the airport terminal type books.
I think you're right, yeah. Frank. Thank you for the call.
And Tony, is there a larger format coffee table electronic reader for your larger format picture book?
I'm not sure. I think it's called an Etch-a-Sketch, isn't it? Oh, I just mentioned the product name.
We are going to be talking books for the remainder of the program, but I believe Jim Graham is ready to go. Jim, hit us with those news headlines, if you could.
Good on you, Tony. Shall do.
Tony Martin and Tony Wilson on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
And tonight we're talking books. Can we go to Matt, who's out on the Hume? Matt, what have you got to say for yourself?
Guys, I don't imagine you condone driving and talking on the phone, so I'm far too pumped to hang up, so we'll be brief.
Yes, good on you.
Kudos on playing XTC, by the way.
Yeah, you don't hear enough XTC these days.
You're right, it was their last studio album, but it was part of a session that they went in and recorded and made two albums out of in one sitting.
That's right.
The other one was Apple Venus, which I happen to have on me for this road trip. And speaking of which, I pulled into a service station and bought an audio book. And I haven't had an audio book for years. My father gave me War of the Worlds on cassette when I was very young. I thought this would be a novel, no pun intended, idea to have this CD play. And it's this book or audio book called Don't Tell Mum I Work on the Rig, She Thinks I'm a Piano Player in a Whorehouse.
Right.
By a guy called Paul Carter, and it's just his adventures as an oil rigger. He's an Aussie, but I think he's the guy reading the story. He's got a very English accent and lives in WA, but really, really interesting, thoroughly compelling, but such a heavy listen that I had to turn it off.
I've actually had that book recommended to me several times, Matt. Can you say the title again?
It's called Don't Tell Mum I Work on the Rig, She Thinks I'm a Piano Player in a Whorehouse.
Fantastic. And you got this at the service station, you say?
Yeah, I can't remember which servo, but somewhere along the stretch, early in the piece, maybe as far, I've just driven from Sydney, so maybe as early as Pheasant's Nest or maybe Yass or something.
And do you buy a lot of talking books?
I haven't probably listened to anything audio like this since War of the Worlds, or maybe I've got a Frankenstein cassette somewhere too, but certainly nothing since the cassette medium.
How do you feel about the abridged talking books? I always find that, you know, it's lazy enough that you're listening to the book rather than reading it. Can't you at least listen to the whole thing, always say?
Well, and here's the thing. I'm dyslexic, so it's ideal for me because I retain oral and visual information very, very well, but I can't stand to read as much as two pages of any book and subsequently never have. I'm a huge fan of Serge Gainsbourg, the French pop artist, and I was determined to know all I could about the guy and bought this biography and got like halfway through it and never ever picked it up again and don't remember anything more than I already knew as sort of hearsay or, wise tales about the guy, because I just can't commit written word to memory. But I already know so much about this Paul Carter guy. His wife's thoroughly interesting and makes mine look sad by comparison, and maybe that's the beauty of escapism that you can put in a book or on an audio book.
Well, we're just losing you there, Matt, on the Hume, but thank you for your recommendation.
No sweat. You should get this book. It's fantastic.
Will do. Thank you. We have Brian from Blackburn. You've got a very important book you'd like to tell us about. Is that right, Brian?
Well, it was at the time.
Yeah.
A late ex-girlfriend gave me a book and just said, read this, because her girlfriend was on a beach in Hawaii.
Right.
And apparently she was just weeping, and people were coming up and say, are you all right, darling? You know, is there anything we can do? I said, no, it's just the book. So anyhow, she gave it to me and said, well, read this. And it's a short book. And I read it in about 4.5 hours, and it was a gut buster. And it was a real heartbreaker.
Well, do you want to give us the title?
Bridges of Madison County.
Oh, the Bridges of Madison County.
Yeah, and I don't know whether it was a one-off. I think it might have been a one-hit wonder for the author.
Waller, somebody. Well, I think he did do a couple more, but that was his hit single.
Yeah, and Clint Eastwood obviously was pretty impressed with it, and he went out and made a film about it. And it
didn't hit the same heights, I believe, for people who enjoyed the book.
Yeah, I thought Meryl Streep was miscast in that, but that's just my own little thoughts, but it was a fantastic book, and I would never read a book on a computer. It has to be pages, paper, and don't fold the, put something in the book. Don't fold the page over. And there's a little bit of respect for the book there, but anyhow, that's my nerdy little thing.
No, I've never heard, it's generally referred to as chick lit, that book, but I'm glad to hear you recommend it, because I know a lot of people do like the film. That was one of those ones where the book is generally slagged off, isn't it?
Yes.
But the film tended to get quite good reviews, I think. Am I wrong there?
I think the book was like humongous. It sold everywhere. And the film was not such a big hit, especially when you got, Clint Eastwood was actually in it, and Clint Eastwood directed it and probably produced the thing.
And failed to shoot anybody at any point, so that was a disappointment for a lot of viewers.
Yeah, there was no gunfight.
Sadly, no.
Brian, thank you for your Bridges of Madison County plug. And speaking of books intended for women that have exploded, I've heard of an actual man who's reading a Stephanie Meyer book.
Really?
This week I met a man who's doing it.
Is that right? Yeah. This isn't just you. You're not making it.
It's not me. I haven't tried yet. I'm thinking of giving it a go. And now that I've heard that another man is, I might do so.
Yeah,
but certainly the vast majority, the quorum has been women so far.
Well, I was told that I could sell a lot more books if I included more sullen, moody, young, pale vampires. And I never got round to doing that. Greg from Laylaw, you've got something to say about shipping costs. Is that right?
That's right, Tony. With what you were saying before about the cost of a book
yeah.
in Australia as compared to actually purchasing that book from, say, that company in America, in the United States of America, that has the same name as a female South American woman,
yes,
a warrior, that company.
Let's just call them Company X.
We'll call them Company A.
Okay.
Who actually also own that aforementioned Rudy you were talking about before.
That's right. They're sort of pushing it. And they've modified it a few times, but people aren't really biting yet, are they?
No. There's a couple of reasons for that. But just on the pricing of books, if you were to just put it to, I do textbooks all the time, but I only actually import them when the Australian dollar goes over 80 cents.
Right.
Because it's not, the exchange rate's not there. But if you were going to do one book, like one textbook, which in Australia goes around, retails for about $100 to $120 in any bookshop. If you were to actually import that book, it'd probably cost you more than that, right, just that one book. But if you were to actually bundle up, say, six or eight books at a time, which might cost you anywhere between, say, last shipment I did was six books, cost me, with freight, landed cost them to my door, was $360 for six books. Well, that's $60. That's half the price to me.
That's right. So you've got to. That's what I do. I tend to wait till I've got three or four things that I want to order.
Yeah, you'd have to wait about 30 if you want to buy novels, though.
Well, I notice what tends to happen is a book will come out here in what's called trade paperback. You know, very few books come out in hardcover now. So the trade will be generally, I think the recommended is about anywhere between $29.95 and $36.95.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And, you know, you might get it for $25 at some shops, but generally, let's say it's around about $30.
Yeah.
And then you'll find the same title on Company A's website for usually $16.95.
That's right. But if you try to buy that, though, it's going to cost you about $50 to get out here.
That's right. But then what we're talking about is usually a hardcover.
Yeah.
So that's got a certain attraction in itself. But, yeah, if the exchange rate's down about in the mid-60s, and once you add the postage, it ends up being pretty much the same or a bit more,
well,
does it not?
If it was at 60 cents, it'd be a lot more. It would be.
Yeah.
Because of the... And depending on what type of freight you're doing, too, you can... I mean, those books I talked about before, I did them fast rate express, and the freight out of the 360 was $90. I could have reduced that by half by doing slow freight.
Mm. And what's a good book that you want to recommend to us while you're there, Greg?
Well, a good book. Gosh, I don't know. There's another little American company that has another reader, which is a more popular type of phone type reader, which you can actually put your books on, so you can do that. And before you were talking about how would you do it for your desktop, or your tabletop, or your coffee top, was a thing called a tablet. You could actually do it on that.
Fantastic.
So those are the sort of things you can do, the options on those readers. But those readers aren't actually, they change them all the time because they're trying to stop people pirating the electronic versions.
Right, and is that easy to do?
Absolutely. It's very hard to pirate a hard copy book because you have to photocopy every page, which might take you time and takes you paper as well.
But we immediately get
electronic copy. You can easily break the cycle, break the lock that's on the electronic copy, and that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to lock.
You don't want to see that.
About with that reader, trying to lock the copy into the device.
So before you know it, we'll just have blokes in the pub car park selling, illegal burns of Dostoevsky out of the boot of a car.
That's right.
We don't want to see that.
The other amazing thing about books is, I mean, like 20 years ago, I bought a set of Encyclopedia Britannica, and I shouldn't have said that, but that I should have said something like that well-known British...
Yeah. It's a minefield. It certainly is. Good on you for trying, though, Greg.
Yeah, sorry about that.
It's okay.
But now, that's now sitting... I have an edition of that sitting in my bookshelf at home, which is right next to my piano. It looks absolutely fantastic. I don't know that it would actually look fantastic as a subscription on the internet.
No, that's right.
And if I left the subscription, I've now lost all that information until I've now re-established the subscription again.
No, the decorative quality of books, the physical beauty of the object itself is sort of going missing in the
that's
reader.
Right.
Books do furnish a room.
Before. I mean, when you have a book that's about a subject, like, yeah, I think his subject was military, And but another subject could be flowers or you know, space and all that. Those put into a book and put it on a table, a coffee table, is fantastic. I mean, you could do the same thing with electronics, but you know, you have to keep on powering them up.
No, I hope we didn't let go of that guy before, because I'm sure Tony and I are keen to get hold of that one about military guns.
Yeah, right.
He sounded like a fascinating gauge he was talking about there.
Greg.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg. Thank you for contributing. Time for some more music. You're listening to 774 Melbourne, ABC Victoria. 1300 222 774 is the number to call us, or you can SMS on 19774 774. Here's the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. Thank you. The yes here on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. Tony Martin and Tony Wilson filling in for Derek Gill and having what I think has been a very civilised discussion about books.
Yeah, we have. Yeah. We love them. I'm currently reading a Tony Martin recommendation, which is Consider the Lobster by David Foster Wallace, a collection of his essays, and I've just read the title essay about whether or not lobsters feel pain when they hit the hot water.
That is a beauty. The whole book is fantastic.
It's got incredible stuff in it. There's another one about English usage, prescriptivists versus descriptivists. Who would have thought there was a war going on?
There's also a very, very good, hilarious account of visiting the Pornography Awards too. Or a pornography expo.
And a John McCain story about his first crack at the presidency back in 2000 and whether or not there was a fairly convenient question asked, effectively a Dorothy Dixer.
He was a great writer, David Foster Wallace. That's one of his two non-fiction books. His other one is called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, which has his famous essay about going on a sort of Love Boat-style cruise, which is... He writes... They're hilarious, but his intention is not to be funny. I don't think... you wouldn't call him a humour writer.
I always thought that he was for the beret set. I always thought he was too smart for me.
Well, his fiction's pretty hard to... Infinite Jest is a hard one to get through.
And yet, when you read his non-fiction, he is just funny. Like, it's easy to read and funny and brilliant.
Well, the irony, I think, with David Foster Wallace is that he was, let's not beat about the bush, he killed himself last year, and he was someone who was very unhappy with his writing, amongst other things. He felt that he wasn't achieving in his fiction the level of communication with his readers that he wanted to, and yet every problem that he had with his own fiction was something that he was achieving in his non-fiction. That's the sad thing, from a writing point of view, I mean. Not commenting on other aspects of his life, I don't know anything about that.
Well, in describing the Maine Lobster Festival, he talked about tourism, and whenever he sees tourists, he regards them as insects on a dead carcass. They don't belong there, and it was quite just a graphic. He wasn't a fan of tourists.
How was his, the one he did about 9/11? I mean, how many things have been written about 9/11, or 11/9, if we want to be precise? And, you know, his one, which is just, he was visiting some relatives and...
Visiting a neighbour, a member of his church in some Midwestern town. And it was just about the way the shock within this tiny community in America and the far-reaching nature of that tragedy. And also about flag ownership. He was just surprised at how many people just could muster up a flag within 24 hours.
And just great little images like the oddness of hearing someone mowing their lawn while the towers are coming down. Just things like that. Now, great writer, David Foster Wallace. Look, we have a caller, Adele from Pran, is on the line. You've got a recommendation for us, Adele?
Hi, Tony.
Hello.
Nice to talk to you. Back in my graduate year in 2005, I was doing animation, and I was making a film about this countess and someone, because it was very bloody, and someone recommended American Psycho to me. They thought I would enjoy it.
Brett Easton Ellis's American Psycho, which I think is still sold in the protective plastic container, is it not?
I got mine. I had to get mine from overseas, so to get a hold of it, because I couldn't find it anywhere, and someone said that it was banned. So I went and got it, and I knew I'd seen the film, so I was aware of it might be a bit shocking, and it was very shocking, but it was a real, dare I say, page-turner. Really descriptive stuff, but it was a really good read. And then I went on to recommend it to other people that I was working with, and they'd go away and hand it back and look at me really weirdly and say,
"I'll imagine it, so." It was but, a good read. But you've seen the film is fairly tame compared to the book, isn't it?
Ah, yeah, extremely tame. There was some. I'd been warned of some of the chapters as well, but the great thing about the book is that because the character is so obsessed with detail, there were chapters just totally on like Huey Lewis and the News, the latest album, and
I've never read it, but I think Phil Collins comes out of it fairly badly, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's true, he does.
I found with the movie, the problem I had with the movie is that there's a scene early on where he has an altercation with a barman, and it's revealed almost instantly that this hasn't actually happened, that this is a sort of fantasy sequence, that this is happening in his mind. So then, subsequently, that kind of drains all the suspense out of the film, because whenever something's happening, you're going, well, it's not really happening, is it?
No, and that, I guess that's that Hollywood thing that they do. I know, I think I've heard you previously mention it, that, or it's mentioned that the films just kind of give it all away at the start of the film. But the book is a good read, although shocking.
Yeah, it's not for everybody.
Yeah. No, not for everybody.
American Psycho. Well, I'm shocked to hear that you had to go overseas, because that is, shocking though it is, you do tend to see that book in its little plastic wrapper almost everywhere.
In case the kids try and read it all in the bookshop and get to the bad bits.
Well, I went to, because this was while I was in Brisbane, living in Brisbane, there was a second-hand, big book bonanza sale thing that they have. And if you can't find a book, you go up to this guy that's got a piss helmet on, and he announces over the loudspeakers the book that you're looking for, and if anyone sees it. And so he's announcing very cautiously, if anyone's seen American Psycho, please bring it up. There's a young woman looking for it. So that's to the extent that I went looking for this book.
Now, see, that's what we're going to lose with electronic readers, the bloke in his pith helmet yelling out in the bookshop. Thank you for contributing, Adele.
That's okay. You're welcome. And I'm looking forward to your book signing coming up in the next few weeks in Carlton, I think.
Well, thank you for telling me. I haven't been told where I'm. I just go where they point me. But yes, I think that is happening. Thanks, Adele. And now let's welcome to the panel a man who likes a book or two, the host of ADBC on SBS, which is, I think it's been relocated. Let's ask him himself. Sam Pang, welcome aboard.
Hello, Tony. Thanks for having me on.
That's right. Business out of the way first. What has happened? ADBC has been shifted later?
Yes, it's changed from 8:30, so everyone who was just getting ready to strap in at 8:30, it's actually on at 9 o'clock.
Now, is this due to some of the foul language that some of the historians has been unleashing, do you think?
Yeah, those professors, just it's like a bucks night with some of them. Who would know, Tony? You know television more than me, as you do, Tony. You're involved, Tony W. You were involved in a show.
Yeah, I've had a time slot shift before.
They're always good, aren't they?
Yeah.
No, I think they had to keep you and Costas apart. There was too much tension. There was too much. It was a magic with the two of you that close together.
All I'll say is at 9 o'clock tonight, Tony Martin, you're on tonight. Did you know that you're actually on tonight?
I think I did see myself wearing a very dodgy jumper in the trailer. So
you're on that many times. You were running out of wardrobe.
That's right. You've got to bring your own clothes. I don't have enough clothes for telly. I can't wear this.
No, that's true. You can't wear that.
Do you find yourself barracking for AD or BC each week? Do you have a favourite team?
Usually, from experience, not to give the entire series away, but if you are actually, betting on the show, go the opposite of whatever Tone's team is.
I seem to have got busted down. I was on AD for a while, and then I got busted down to BC. I'm not sure if
that
means.
Thought, much like this time change, we thought that the location change, the team change for you might actually help, but I don't think it did.
It's harder to remember stuff from further ago, isn't it?
I don't think I don't think I actually successfully answer a question in the 12 episodes in which I appear.
That's all right. Did you learn anything, Tone? Did you actually retain anything?
I learned a lot about the Ottoman Empire. Didn't realise they had an air force. They really did. There was an Ottoman air force, and that sounds like a joke, but it's not.
One of the things he took away, I said, I asked him the same question. Have you learnt anything from doing those 12 episodes of ADBC? Yeah. And he said, "There's a planet between Mercury and the Sun. And we looked up, that up on the net. It's just not true.
It's not true.
You've learned the opposite of what the answer was.
That, well, that might have been a history fact or fiction. No, that was fiction, and you've taken it away as a fact.
So right. I'm sure you said, because it was one of your trick questions where you said, the planet Vulcan really exists. And then the person went, no, that's from Star Trek. And you went, wrong. Somebody did find a planet called Vulcan, briefly. Yeah. Or was it later discredited?
No, it was a discredited planet. You had big problems with it every now and then. And I think you actually contributed to a massive change in some of the questions, the wording of questions, because there was a little bit of a double negative every now and again that you, the professors actually would get quite upset at. You know, it was like, fact or fiction, there is a theory to suggest that there's a planet, you know, called Vulcan.
Oh,
and
right,
say,
yeah, right.
That's false. And you'd say, well, actually, it's true that someone did come up with it, you know. And people get upset, and that's when the language started flying. But
People haven't seen the program, basically you've got Sampang and then you've got two teams of two. And the idea with the two teams of two is on each team you have a historian, a professor, an expert, and then someone like me.
Yeah, but that's, you know.
So sort of genius, like you, idiot.
Someone to throw up real content and then someone to just kind of stir that content around.
To make a few references to Dom DeLuise.
Didn't Dom DeLuise feature heavily in the 26 episodes, which we've shot, and of course you were such a big part. But Dom DeLuise, for some reason, was almost involved in every show. So.
Well, I think the name Dom Perignon came up at one point, and right. I thought that was good enough.
You have retained something.
That was enough to mention Dom DeLuise. And you, of course, pointed out that he had an alter ego in Cannonball Run. I'd forgotten about his superhero character.
He actually had two. He had Captain Chaos, which was his alter ego for most of the film. That would get people out of trouble. But then right at the end, Burt Reynolds, J.J. McClure, his character finally got upset. And then tore off the mask, and Dom DeLuise came back with Captain USA. Oh, so he plays three roles in that film.
Yeah, just listen closely, Sam. Can you hear that? They're bringing the music up. I don't know if this is because the news is approaching or we're just talking about Dom DeLuise too much.
When's Derek back?
Derek. What's going to happen is that these two will just come back mid-paragraph talking about Cannonball Run 2 in about... What's 5 minutes, is it?
Derek DeLuise, that's what I'm calling him. Sam, we need you to stick around. We're going to talk more about books, and I understand football is going to be canvassed at some point.
Well, there's a big game tomorrow. You know nothing about it, so I found someone who does.
All right, that'll be soon. Next up, the news on 774.
Tony Martin and Tony Wilson on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
That's right. Good evening to you. The two Tonys are here. Sam Pang is with us on the panel, and I think the intention was that Sam, being another ex-footballer, might introduce some serious football talk onto the program, but you don't seem keen, Sam.
I've completely lost interest.
What are your credentials, sorry? Because, I have to say, you don't look like a footballer to me.
Really? What's your idea of a footballer? Is it that man
tall,
over there?
Tall, hulking guys, I would have thought.
As opposed to short,
I'm not
portly,
saying,
short, portly men.
I never said portly. You've added portly yourself.
I just like that word. I played 14 games for the Collingwood Under-19s as a permanent forward pocket and kicked one goal.
And that was your high point?
Yes. Well, in 14 games, one goal. The club made a pretty, I would say, unfair summation that wasn't quite enough and decided not to draft me.
Do you know what he is most famous for, though?
What's that?
He was at Collingwood, I believe. It was either Sam Pang or his partner in crime down at their club, Brendan Murray. The two of them were still very good friends. The coach asked them to do 10 push-ups one day. And
that's not very many.
But the way the system works, Tone, is it's the same as in Full Metal Jacket.
Oh, yeah.
Where if you ask to do 10 push-ups, it's not a negotiable, it's 10 push-ups.
Yeah, sure.
The two of them delayed doing the 10 push-ups and asked the question, why not 9 or 11?
How did that go down?
Not well, Tone, and that is why I am
an ex-footballer. That is why he is an ex-footballer.
And did you have an Ali Ermey-style coach?
We felt like, you know, Abbott and Costello with that sort of hard-hitting question, and you know, the fellow other players, they loved it, but the match committee and the coaches didn't seem to appreciate it. If you're asked to do 10, Tone, I know that you're big on sport, and physical activity.
I can do push-ups. I can do that.
I doubt that very much.
Do you know that my great...
How can you look at me and say, yes, I could do 10 push-ups?
Well, I can do about 50 push-ups. Because I'm quite skinny, so I'm quite light. There's not a lot to push up. I can actually do... I'll do push-ups occasionally when I feel like I have to do my annual bit of exercise.
See, Tone, my great non-football moment was in a school match against Assumption College at Kilmore. And before the bounce, my opponent turned around and just punched me in the face.
Right.
And I said to him, so what do you think of the situation in Bosnia? And he went, oh, you're just an expletive idiot. And punched me again. So that was the equivalent of Tom. But the equivalent of Sam's existential push-up moment was me getting into geopolitics mid-fight.
Hang on, Tim, we're talking push-up. You're talking like, or what we would say in New Zealand, a press-up, I think that's called.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got your... That's not very hard, is it, 10?
No, it wasn't, Tone. It was about the principle. It was about questioning authority, and it wasn't just do 10.
That bloke had got craned out of his bridge, and Brisbane would be able to do 10, surely.
Yeah, but it was about if I do the 10 that they ask now, then they'll just ask me to do them again. Right. I needed a bit more, Tone. I needed to know what was their theory behind it.
Okay. And do you reckon anyone, I mean, let's get to the game tomorrow.
Okay.
Do you think there's any person of those 44 that will take the field tomorrow that have ever queried why it's 10? Or if they say 20, why it's 20? It's a rule-following profession.
And that's why I was no good at it. But Tone, have you got any questions for about tomorrow's game?
No.
By the way, it's on Saturday, not tomorrow. Tomorrow's Friday.
Yeah, but what's the VFL one?
I might have been getting distracted by tomorrow night's the VFL grand final.
Yeah, that's why we're not going to be crapping on in this time slot.
That's the game you want to talk about. Who's playing in it, Tone?
North Ballarat are playing, and I think they're playing Port Melbourne, but I have to admit that my exertions on this show meant that I nodded off during the ABC's coverage last Sunday afternoon. And so, therefore, I only saw that North Ballarat won against Collingwood on the Saturday, making it a very dirty day for the Pies, losing in both the reserves and the seniors. And then I think Port Melbourne were playing on the Sunday and they were in front when I nodded off. So,
okay. Now, here's a sentence. I don't understand. Our producer, John Standish, who's back to full strength, is the Selkirk Roosters. What does that mean?
The Selkirk Roosters, surely that's the North Ballarat Roosters.
Will be at full strength to tackle the Carlton-aligned...
Northern Bullants. Now, Sam Pang and I both played for the Northern Bullants out Preston way. They were called the Preston Knights or the Preston Bullants at the time.
I'd almost forgotten that I played for that club, Tony Martin. But I did.
How could you forget your time with the Bullants?
He was a journeyman.
I played for 11 clubs, though.
Hang on, look, outside, come on in. We've got a surprise special guest. It's that sort of show.
Wow.
We will get back to this discussion, but please switch on a microphone for John Safran, who's just barged in.
How are you?
It's turning into a race around the world reunion. Welcome aboard, John.
I can't believe you're comparing season one race around the world with season two race around the world.
Is it like Baywatch Nights?
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. It's like, that's like comparing Knight Rider with Knight Rider 2000.
Oh, no.
Or even Blues Brothers with Blues Brothers 2000.
Oh, my God.
You make a good point, John. You often make it to me, is that, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer doesn't go around saying she was in Greece.
Yeah.
She was in Greece too.
Exactly.
And you think that this fan over here won Greece too.
Season 2 Race Around the World, yes, you are right, was the Greece 2 of Race Around the World.
Tony?
It's true that we did kill the show. There was no season 3 of Race Around the World.
Every time we mention Race Around the World on this program, up comes SMSs saying, when's it coming out on DVD? I mean, is that the sort of program that should be preserved?
On DVD. No, because the show works much better as in anecdote form.
I've noticed
because it was like before YouTube DVD. And I've noticed like it gets passed around, what I did on Race Around the World. And it's like Chinese whispers. Oh, sorry about that.
Thank you, Sam Pang. Don Rickles over there. Thank you.
But it becomes like Chinese whispers. And like everyone, it's like, John kicked the ball over the fence in Lebanon, and then this guy from Hamas came with a gun.
Yeah, right.
And then the SWAT team, and then by the time it gets fed back to me, I've done the most amazing, and if it's ever released on DVD, I'm screwed.
It can't live up to that.
Yeah, I can't.
What about that thing with the Ray Martin business that never went to air? Is that on YouTube?
I think so. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So one of the stories that if the DVD comes out,
what's this?
It'll never come out, by the way. The reason it won't come out, I actually have an explanation both for why the show got axed, other than that's John's theory that Series 2 just killed the show. Apparently the safety of races was people were worried of people getting hurt.
I've just been told on the screen, John needs to get back to his recording commitments across the corridor, and they've now underlined it twice.
Oh, no.
So sorry about it. Thanks for joining us, John.
I'll come back in during my next
episode. Just pop in whenever you want. It's an open door policy here at the studios.
And the reason it will never come out on DVD is that we were allowed under ABC policy to play any music underneath our stories.
Course,
and for us to get music clearance,
that would be a nightmare.
It just wouldn't happen.
It would be a nightmare. Let's have some music now. We've got more serious football, and we haven't really got to books with Sam Pang, and he's got an interesting stack of them right in front. You're listening to 774 Melbourne ABC Victoria, Tony Martin and Tony Wilson, filling in for Derek Giel. Right now here is another duo, David Byrne and Brian Eno, Strange Overtones. That's Strange Overtones, David Byrne and Brian Eno from the album Everything That Happens Will Happen Today. Came out in the last year. Don't forget their old one, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. I'm sure that's still available. Sam Pang has joined Tony Wilson and myself on the panel tonight. And Sam, I just want to mention, have we covered off football? Is that really all the big issues have been covered?
I think so.
What were you asking me about when I came here? What did I make of?
I just wanted to get an idea of whether you'd even heard of Australian rules football, given your lack of sporting interest.
Well, no, there was, because we had the All Blacks, and what's that? That's rugby union.
Yeah.
There's just one kind of rugby, and then you come here and there's several. I just found
you had an All Black at your school, didn't you?
Yeah, our headmaster was Tony Steele. We're going to get to that.
You had an All Black as your principal called Steele.
He expelled me and then later sacked my mum, who worked in the office. He's a tough guy.
I just cleaned the house.
But no, I just got here and went, well, why are they calling it Australian rules? We're in Australia. I mean, it would make sense if we were playing another kind of football, Norwegian rules.
Well, they thought it'd make a good title of a movie 100 years down the track when they adapted Deadly Anna into film form.
Right, now, you mentioned scores because, Sam, I know on Community Radio 3RRR, you have often floated the topic with your callers, who did you go to school with?
Yeah, who did you go to school with or who went to your school? Because sometimes you can get to a school and just the word used to just buzz around that, you know, Graham Yallop used to go to your school or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, someone like that.
Didn't John Safran go to your school?
That's what my wonder. John just commandeering your show just reminded me that when I got to Bourne High,
right,
the biggest thing that people kept dropping is that that this guy, John Safran, used to go to the school. Great.
And my mum.
Really?
She went to Bowen High as well.
And do you have, who's at your school?
We had Wayne Arthurs, who became a very prominent tennis player.
Right, okay.
You may remember the chant, "Where's your Wayne at? Where's your Wayne at?"
Or maybe I won't remember that.
Or you
that
may
chant.
Remember.
I have heard it, but I've only heard it in tune tone, so thank you.
He was a hero of one of our Davis Cup campaigns.
Okay, I decided to go and look up who had been to my school because I couldn't think of anybody. See if you recognise any of these names. Cricketer Scott Styrus.
Yes, I reckon he was a one-day specialist.
Really? He was a very clean hitter of the ball from memory.
Was he as good as...
he went to your school.
Was he as good as Ewan Chatfield?
No way.
Actually, can I just say that? Is there only one school over there?
We're talking about the Waikato, Hamilton Boys High School.
Did Ewan Chatfield go to your school?
No, he didn't. No, we weren't that prestigious. Daniel Gillies, actor Daniel Gillies, who played the son of J. Jonah Jameson, the newspaper editor in Spider-Man 2. So he played his son in Spider-Man 2, went to my school. But our most famous person who went there was the Olympic silver medalist Dick Quacks.
And what sport?
He came, well, second, obviously, in the 5,000 metres at Montreal in 1976. Dick Quacks.
I've just thought of our biggest. I've just thought of our biggest one.
Who?
This is Campbell Grammar.
You're going to top Dick Quacks?
Andy Lee.
Oh, okay.
He went to your school.
Yes.
He's more well-known than Dick Quacks.
And Andy Lee, at some point, contacted me to ask about, you know, furthering his career in the business. And the moment that we were level lasted about 2 seconds as he whooshed past.
Right, well.
That list is not great. That bar is not very
high.
You're
not impressed by Dick Quack.
Dick Quack, I'm impressed by his name. And what is funny is that we're making fun of a silver medalist. I know Mr. Pressup's over there, you know, if there's an Olympic event, he'd just pump him out. But this man has come... He's a second in the Olympics.
Here's my Dick Quacks fact for the day. This is from Wikipedia, so I'm assuming it's not vandalism. I'm assuming this is true. On the 13th of October 2007, Dick Quacks lost his bid to become mayor of Manukau, home of Manukau City Centre. Hello, everybody. To Len Brown by 14,000 votes. During this election, Dick Quacks complained to the electoral office over an offensive flyer depicting him and members of his People's Choice Party as the Thunderbirds. His complaint was not upheld, as there was no evidence to suggest who had posted the anti-Quacks flyers. We'll have more Dick Quacks facts as they come to hand.
We do want to know who you went to school with as well. The number 1-300-222-774 and the SMS 1-9-7-7-4-7-7-4. And we've got the quiz coming up as well.
We have got the quiz coming up.
Just to put a positive light with the Quacks.
Dick Quacks,
You know, he lost that, but you could say that he won another silver medal there. He's a dual silver medalist.
Yeah.
Because he was runner-up in the... in that race to be there.
We'll say dual silver medalist Dick Quacks went to my school.
Trying to be positive.
We've got to talk books with you, Sam. You've got a range in front of you. These are imports, are they not? Or imports, if you prefer.
I heard your discussion about prices earlier on. I've got a couple. I know that that thing on the internet where you can buy music. We're not allowed to name any names. I think $1.69 for a song, that seems to be the going rate for... a single is $1.69, which I think is fantastic value. What else can you buy $1.69?
It's mixed lollies or a song, isn't it?
And yeah, that's right. And then the other that makes you not want to steal the music anymore.
I've given up stealing since it became available for $1.69.
That's right.
And speaking of Tony Martin recommendations, which you mentioned before, I got a couple from you, Tony Martin. One is Live from New York, an uncensored history of Saturday Night Live.
I don't think that has been published here.
Right.
So but you would have had to have got that from overseas, I'm guessing.
I did at the
Company
bookstore. A. Yeah, Company A, the jungle one. And basically, if you read all 620 pages, at the end of that, basically everyone hates Chevy Chase.
That's right.
That's one there.
I think that's,
that's a review of that.
And there's a later edition where they give Chevy Chase a rebuttal, I think. But that is, it's the history of Saturday Night Live sort of told in the voice of everyone who was there.
Yeah,
it's a great book.
It is a great book. Now, this one that I've got here that's called And Here's the Kicker.
Oh, this is a corker.
Conversations with 21 Top Humor Writers on Their Craft by Mike Sachs. Is that being released here?
Don't think that's coming. That's only been out in America for about a month, so I had to get that from Company A.
Have you got a favourite writer's memoir?
Writer's memoir?
I loved the Neil Simon books. The playwright Neil Simon has written a book called... the sequel is called The Play Must Go On, and the first book is called Rewrites. But both rewrites, whether you love Neil Simon or not, and some people, I think, might find his plays a little dated. You know, they're that real sort of old-style gag-type play. He was I think he wrote on the Sid Caesar Show and stuff like that.
Yeah, sure.
But his career in theatre in the 60s and 70s in New York is just fantastic, and those books are brilliantly written and quite inspiring for anyone who's tried to write to write, because he's found it hard, and he's talked about how to get through finding it hard.
Well, someone gave me Act One by Moss Hart. That's a beauty. About this is a very suspenseful account of putting on a Broadway production. But this one that Sam is wielding, it's 21 comedy writers and...
Harold Ramis, well, some of them.
Give us some of the names.
Buck Henry, I'll just list them and you can tell.
Henry was the co-creator of Get Smart, and then wrote The Graduate. And I think his last thing I would have seen his name on was To Die For with Nicole Kidman. Yeah.
Stephen Merchant.
From The Office, co-writer of The Office. Yeah.
Dan Mazer.
Dan Mazer, isn't he? He co-writes all of Ali G's gear, I think.
Just word association. Possibly. With the Two Tones Tonight. Bob Odenkirk.
Oh, Bob Odenkirk is a legend. He was, one of the two guys from Mr. Show with David Cross. He also wrote for Saturday Night Live for years and created the character of Matt Foley, played by Chris Farley.
He also played
Larry Sanders' manager in the Larry Sanders Show.
And also has a recurring role in Curb Your Enthusiasm. Dick Cavett?
Dick Cavett was a talk show host, possibly one of the best ever interviewers on American television, Dick Cavett. And you can get a lot of his old interviews on DVD now.
Harold Ramis.
Well, we know Harold Ramis.
Do you know...
director of Groundhog Day, Caddyshack.
Called my son Harry, and there was some talk that he was going to be Harold, and there was some idea of paying tribute to Dad as Harold Raymond. And I was wondering if he'd notice if he'd mind if I didn't call him Harold Raymond, but I called him Harold Ramis Wilson, just to make tribute to the director of
Stripes. To Dr. Egon Spengler from Ghostbusters.
What I've learnt, though, with a quick initial read, is that he talks about Harold Ramis as the director of Caddyshack. He's asked a question about Rodney Dangerfield. Now, Rodney Dangerfield played, I think, Al Cervic in that movie, where basically, I know that you were shaking your head, T. Wilson, because you think is one of the most disgraceful performances in the history of cinema, as opposed to, I'm not sure what Tony Martin thinks. I just think the genius to take someone's stand-up act and just put it in a scene.
The way it's just crowbarred in with no real concessions made to the art of screen acting whatsoever. It's just Dangerfield wandering on the screen and saying, "Did somebody step on a duck?" It's pretty funny. Yeah,
and he's asked whether Rodney Dangerfield was a good improviser, and his answer is terrible. Awful. And this is the bit that I get to stun. They were originally going to use Don Rickles.
You travelled to America for a week in order to see Don Rickles at some casino.
I hope everyone knows who Don Rickles is.
The insult comic. The king of insult comics.
The merchant of venom.
The man who can make the word dummy sound like the filthiest word you've ever heard.
So I've just found out that Don Rickles was originally slated to be in Caddyshack, which is kind of mildly shattering. But then it just goes on to talk about Dangerfield just not being able to improvise. And, it just confirmed what we all thought about. What a great decision to take someone's stand-up act and just put it... Just incorporated into scenes.
The name of this book is And Here's the Kicker, Conversations with 21 Top Humour Writers on Their Craft by Mike Sachs. And the one that really blew me away in this is a guy, I didn't know his name really. I'd seen his name amongst 20 writers on The Simpsons, George Mayer. Have you read that one yet?
I haven't read that one.
He's like the genius. He's the one who all the other Simpsons writers look up to.
Really?
And that, I think, is the best interview in the book. And he's one of those people who says things that you go, I've thought that for years and I've never been able to put it into words.
Well, I only recently found out, that when it says co-created by, Matt Groening, James L. Brooks and Sam Simon?
Yeah.
You know that Sam Simon and the other two fell out.
Is that right?
Yes.
Was that because of Sam Simon's movie The Super with Joe Pesci? Could it have been because of that?
That would have been enough.
Look, there's a bit of angst out there.
Okay, sorry.
People want their quiz.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
But
sorry,
before we get to the quiz, I chucked in a little diversion in the form of who you went to school with, request for calls. And we've got both an SMS and a call. One is, I went to school with Gina Riley. She didn't like me and I didn't like her. That's from Helen. But we've also got Craig from Melton. He's on the line. You there, Craig?
Craig, are you with us?
No,
he's gone. No, he's had enough.
He went to school with Gina Riley as well.
Too many mentions of Dick Quacks for his liking. Sam, do you want to stick around and see how a professional radio quiz goes to air?
I do. It's one of the...
Look at Tony Wilson fumbling for a stack of papers. Just, that's not the Derek Gill way.
Just on cue.
Hit the music. Let's have it. Let's get started. Oh, hang on. Okay. That's more like it. Sorry, the orchestra weren't ready. Hands down.
1-300-222-774. Last night we had Pete Smith, of course, giving you the big voice.
That's right.
Tonight, you're stuck with my monotones, Monotony Wilson here, with the quiz. The carryover question is, which Australian-born author has won the Booker Prize twice? The number 1-300-222-774.
That's right.
Is there one question with the quiz?
It's not one question over 10 minutes.
The 10 minutes starts now.
The 10 minutes has begun. Okay. We do have a caller. Sam from Sandringham is with us. Did you hear the question, Sam?
I didn't, gentlemen. You'll have to repeat it.
It's a carryover question. This one no one got at the end of last night's quiz, and that is, which Australian-born author has won the Booker Prize twice?
The Booker Prize twice.
Now, keep in mind that our last caller on last night's broadcast suggested that the correct answer was Tom Jones.
Tom Jones.
And okay. We had to dissuade her of that.
Okay. I'm tempted to say Dick Quacks, but...
I am at every possible moment.
I'm actually changing my name by Deepole tomorrow. Now, it's either going to be Peter Carey or Tim Winton.
Would it help you if I told you that four people answered Tim Winton last night?
And were wrong.
Yeah, somewhat.
So you're going for Peter Carey?
I am going for Peter Carey.
Correct.
What?
Well, I hope you guys take this show on forever, because I've never got a question right with Derek, and I've got three right with you so far.
Well, saddle up for the next easy one. What okay. is the floral emblem of Australia?
While you're thinking...
that's not easy for me.
While you're thinking, that number, 1-300-222-774.
Is that a clue?
No.
Okay, the floral emblem of Australia... Ooh, I'm thinking echidna, but I'm not sure.
How are the echidnas going?
It's either going to be like kangaroo paw, but probably not that.
No, probably not.
The floral...
A severed kangaroo paw.
Can you give me a clue?
8 minutes.
What about Australia's one-day cricket uniform?
Australia's one-day cricket uniform...
Is there a quacks question in this quiz?
I'm hoping there will be. 1-300-222-774.
Yellow and green. Is it something like a yellow box?
No, you're gone.
No, sorry, okay. Sam. Sorry. Pamela from Bingen Worry. And I'm certainly hoping that's how you pronounce your home.
No, it's Bingen Worry.
It is. And somebody told me you that the other night. Bingen Worry. Sorry. I'll just think binge drinking whenever I see that coming up. Pamela, here's your question. Tony?
It looks like Bingen Worry here on the screen. What is the floral emblem of Australia?
Would it be the desert pea?
No.
Oh, sorry about that. You've let down Bingen Worry, I'm afraid, Pamela. We'll move on to Gary from Parkdale. The floral
7 minutes.
Emblem of Australia. What is it, Gary?
I'm thinking golden wattle.
Yes.
Yes, it is the golden wattle. Of course it is.
Of course it is.
Actor Angus Sampson's full name is Angus Murray Lincoln Sampson. What do his first three names have in common? They are Angus Murray Lincoln.
Are they types of cattle?
Oh, yes, they certainly are. He's got a novelty name, does Angus Sampson.
What coloured jumper was Darryl Baldock wearing when he held up the cup for St Kilda after their only premiership win in 1966?
Okay, this is close to Sam Pang's heart, I think.
How so,
Pangy?
Oh, I don't want to give it.
Black and white.
It's fantastic.
Can you believe that now, Tony Martin? Do you understand what has happened there?
I don't understand anything that's been said in the last 30
Darryl
seconds.
Darryl Baldock was the captain of St Kilda, who are a red, white,
Six
and
minutes.
Black.
Yeah.
And they when they won in 1966, but there was a tradition that players swap jumpers.
Oh, actually, I have heard about this. So in the photo,
There's no photo of a St Kilda player holding up. All it's right. only his face you've got to recognise. Who is the president of France?
You don't have any more AFL questions?
I'm afraid not.
Okay, let me see.
He's on the news all the time.
He is? It's not a French name, is it?
Depends if you pronounce it French.
Sarkozy?
Nicolas Sarkozy. Okay.
Nicolas Sarkozy.
And out of 10, how hot is his wife? No, that's not the next question at all, actually. Name one of Greg Evans's co-hostesses on Perfect Match.
Oh, no. Dexter wasn't a co-host, was he?
No, he tried to white out his way in, but he never did it.
How would you describe Dexter's role, Tom?
Ballast.
Okay.
I can think of four female co-hosts on Perfect Match.
Did Elise Platt have a run?
No, I'm afraid not. You're thinking Sale of the Century. Sorry, Gary. We'll move on to Paul from Ferntree Gully. Paul, can you name any of the female co-hosts on Perfect Match with Greg Evans?
Perfect Match. That was just a robot, wasn't it?
Nah, Dexter was, he was off to the side, but there was always...
Before he became a serial killer.
Yeah, that's right.
No, but I loved your book, Tony. Lolly Shop. It was a really good book.
Lolly Shop. We've had lolly bags and now Lolly Shop. Thank you, Paul. Thank you.
Ring up with what Tony Martin's first novel should have been called.
Karen from Sunshine, can you name any of the female co-hosts on Perfect Match?
I knew all the others. But this one, I just don't know. Sorry.
Oh, sorry, Karen. We'll
move... 4 minutes.
All right. Move on to Chris from Blair Gowrie. Any of the female co-hosts?
Yeah, my mother named one of them, Tiffany Lamb.
Tiffany Lamb. You could have said Kerry Friend or Debbie Newsom or Unky from Sweden, but we will accept Tiffany Lamb.
Spell Bain-Marie.
Say it again?
Spell Bain-Marie, or is it? How would you pronounce it, Tom?
I've eaten enough sausage rolls out of them, but... Bain-Marie. It's.
I would pronounce it Bain-Marie as well, but it's a slightly misleading.
No. So we're not spelling it as it sounds, are we?
No.
Okay. Any hints on? Is it like a little tick above one of the E's or the A's?
Oh, no, I'm not going to worry about accents.
You're not going to worry about umlauts. Sorry.
Yeah, umlauts. Or all I can tell you. Is,
well, starting with a B, obviously.
Yeah, yes. That's right.
Then we'll probably have to throw in a vowel, so we'll go with a. Oh, I don't know.
Then
A.
3 minutes. A is B-A. You're doing well.
Yes, well, we're working it. Maybe possibly another vowel.
Yes.
I'll throw in an E.
No, sorry about that, Chris. You failed on the Bain-Marie test. Moving on to Craig.
Distracted.
Now it's Wheel of Fortune.
Craig from Sandringham, are you there?
I am.
Do you have a crack at spelling Bain-Marie?
My Lord. B-A-I.
Yes.
M-A-R-I-E?
No. Right, you're very close, but not close enough, Craig. Moving on to Catherine from Wangaratta. Bain-Marie, have a go. No. Right, you're very close. Catherine?
Well, and maybe turn the radio down, Catherine.
Yes, you're hearing us 7 seconds after we're actually speaking to you. Turn down the radio, Catherine, and see if you can spell Bain-Marie.
I think it's B-A-I-N-E.
Yes.
M-A-R-I-E?
No, afraid not. Very close.
Jeez, you did some heavy lifting, Catherine.
Two minutes.
Paul from Ballarat, can you spell Bain-Marie?
Let's just
say there is a hyphen between the two parts of it.
Right. Did they have the second part correct?
I can't really help you in that regard.
All right, look, I'm not...
Have a go, Paul.
Come on, have a go, Paul.
B-A-I.
Yes.
They were going well before.
Right. M.
No, sorry, not sorry, Paul. Jason from Burwood East, can you spell Bain-Marie?
G'day, guys. I'll give it a go.
Yep.
B-A-I.
Yep.
Hyphen.
No, afraid
too early with the hyphen.
Paul. This is like the toughest question we've ever had. Jason.
People are getting distracted by the image of Dim Sims.
Jason from Burwood East, don't be distracted by the rising steam.
This is your last minute.
See if you can spell Bain-Marie. He's gone. It's the Bain Marie challenge. He's defeated him. William from Yarra Valley. Bain Marie, care to spell it?
Oh, good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
You've been an absolutely great Philip over the past fortnight.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, but the clock is ticking. Bain Marie.
B-A-I-N hyphen M-A-I-R-E.
Oh, no, so very, very close, I'm afraid not. Mark from Bendigo.
It was Bain Mayor, wasn't it?
He was spelling Bain Mayor, the mayor who's the bane of town. Mark from Bendigo, can you spell Bain Marie?
Sorry, what's the word again?
Bain Marie.
Bain Marie.
Bain Marie. Let's see, B-A-I-N-E.
No, I'm afraid not. Sorry, Mark. Oh, no.
No, do you know what, Tony?
The wheels have fallen off the Bain Marie.
Ring up and spell Dick Quacks. Just give it away.
I am sick to death of the prize not going off, and we are just throwing the rule book out onto South Bank Boulevard.
Because if this mess isn't cleaned up, Derek Gibb's going to have to sort this out.
I can't see you over the stack of prizes.
The prize is enormous. Okay, let's keep calling. 1-300-222-774. Nick from Marino, can you spell Bain Marie?
Oh, yeah, how do you want it? In French or English?
We'd like anything we'll do at this point. It's just correct. Same.
The real word is au bain marie.
Yep.
That's A-U.
Oh, yeah.
B-A-I-N.
Yes.
M-A-R-I-E.
That is it. Yes.
And you've given us some bonus fat on top.
If you slash off the A-U at the top, it's spelt the same in Australian. B-A-I-N. M-A-R-I-E is correct. All right, what happens
and
now?
Nick from Marino, tell me you didn't want The Cut starring John Wood. Not all the sharks are in the ocean. That's for you. Being Human Series 1 is coming your way. Agatha Christie's Marple. Why Didn't They Ask Evans is in the pack.
There's some good stuff too coming up too, Tony.
Australia, Folk Songs and Bush Verse. We tried to give that away on Tuesday, but no dice. Convict Stained to Shearer's Blades. And finally, the delightful Wide Open Road, a road trip through Australia's musical landscape. And that, of course, includes the magic Triffitt song, Wide Open Road, as the opening track.
That's all yours, Nick from Marina.
I have to learn to read and write.
Well, this is...
Yeah. You don't have to learn how to spell, though, Nick, because you've done that.
You know the French pronunciation and spelling.
It was a pleasure.
All right. Good on you, Nick. And thank you, everybody who participated. Sam, do you want to stick around?
Oh. Wow, I'm tired after that, but I'd love to.
There's more coming up, but right now it is the time of the evening when we play some Frank Sinatra, our last chance to play a bit of Frank. And if I can just reach over, the album I've selected is Swing Along With Me on the Reprise label with Billy May and his orchestra. Let's hear You're Nobody Till Somebody Loves You. Yeah, that's Frank Sinatra, You're Nobody Till Somebody Loves You, from the album Sinatra Swings, also known as Swing Along With Me, one of those confusing albums that has two titles. Tony Martin and Tony Wilson filling in for Derek Gill tonight on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. Sam Pang riding along with us in the sidecar. Just quickly...
Our show's about to start too in about 12 minutes.
Oh, right.
I've got to get to the studio and...
Because it does go to a live ADBC on SBS.
Of course it does. You played Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, I did.
Now, you were talking books before. Well, I brought in Rickles' book.
Now this is Don Rickles' book, simply called Rickles' Book.
A memoir. Bit concerning. It does say with David Ritz, which is, it's like as told to. So I'm pretty comfortable that Don had very little to do with actual writing the book. But his opening chapter is a story about Frank.
Right.
And really, as with most of the stories in it, just starts with, I was at the Sands Casino one night.
Yeah.
And basically, Don was having a lovely dinner with a young girl. She saw, Frank was over in the corner. This girl asked Don if he knew Frank. Don said, of course, I'm like a brother to him.
Right.
Went over and he said, Frank, it'd really help me out if you could just come over. It'd be a big, you know, really give me a big boost tonight if you just come over, you know, give me a 10 minutes and come over and say hello to the table. So he goes back. Frank takes 20 minutes. So Rickles is actually at the table with this girl, just sweating. He's wondering if Frank's going to come. Frank strolls over and says, Hello, Don. You know, good to see you. And Rickles stands up and says, not now, Frank. Can't you see I'm with somebody?
Bang. Probably called him a dummy as well.
A hockey puck or something.
A hockey puck. Thank you, Sam. If you could stick around at least.
I can't wait to hear the next guest.
We have Tony. Who have you brought in?
We have a very special guest. His name is Lachlan Carter, and he contacted me a few months ago with quite an original idea. It's called Pigeons, and I don't want to say too much about it because Lachlan is here to do just that. Thanks for coming in, Lachlan.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks, Tony. Thanks, Sam.
Can you tell these guys what the Pigeons you've got me into?
Yeah, Pigeons. Okay, we Pigeons is a literacy program that my partner and I are running with North Melbourne Primary School, and we basically got 12 authors working with 12 kids in a year 4-5 grade, and they're writing stories together in a collaborative collaborative writing exercise, and it's through the exchange of letters. So the kids correspond with the authors, give them feedback on the writing that they're doing. You've had an experience, Tony, where one of your kids has not taken the advice that you've given him with the story and how it's going.
Oh, this is interesting. What's happened?
Well, this is... the kid.
Now,
the kid
maybe don't say any names.
I won't say his name.
I think that's wrong.
But he is 9 years old. He started off by saying, hi, I'm 9 years old. I want to write a comedy adventure story and I really like stories about fights.
Okay.
And so, there you go. I've heard you're a good writer. Can you give me something that starts off in that direction? So, I've started writing a story about fights. And we've now got into some heated letter writing discussion on just how many fights we can have in our story and how quickly and over how many decades.
And what's the point of difference between you?
Well, my correspondent wants to throw... I started with fight one and I set it in a classroom and there's kind of a magical realist element to why this person is fighting. And my 9-year-old correspondent ignored my fight in the classroom, chucked them 7 years forward and made another fight on a sidewalk with Source's blood.
Right, so this is it a sort of a tag team kind of arrangement?
Yeah, my story is meant to feed into my starting paragraph.
So how many words? You do a paragraph?
Yeah, a paragraph or two. And then my correspondent knocks out a couple of paragraphs and keeps the momentum of the story going. Then I get a go. And basically, tell me if I'm doing anything wrong Lachlan.
It's pretty much like it. It's sort of like an exquisite corpse, but one, you know, where, you know, one person does part of the story, next person does it a bit more, but there's a correspondence around it that sort of helps form that editing process.
When you had the idea for this though, Lachlan, did you think that there'd be a feud? Is that what you were looking for in terms of the relationship between the kids and the authors?
Not sure if we were looking for it, hoping for it as well. You know, we wanted there to be at least some sort of dynamic, you know, conversation around the story that they're writing and having something like, you know, I don't know if an argument was what we were after, but at least, you know,
robust debate.
Debate is a great way to put it. But I mean, it's giving those kids a real opportunity to think about what they're putting into their story and getting that feedback from a professional in the field, which is a really great experience.
Lachlan, you will defend me and say that my letter wasn't all mean. It wasn't like I was coming over the top like a headmaster. I told him I loved the Source bit, for example.
And your letter was perfect because it's also the kids, they feel like they're, you know, it's a one-on-one sort of situation. So there's not a mentorship where Tony's giving advice and the kid feels like, well, you're right. So
Lachlan just did tell me off air that had I knocked back his next paragraph, because he's had another crack, he's rewritten the bit that I was struggling with, apparently it was take it or leave it. he was willing to defend that bit to the hilt.
Which is great. We helped him through that writing process where he's going, I really want this to happen. I was like, well, tell Tony that. Tell him that you want it to be in there. He's like, okay, I will.
Who are the other authors involved?
There's 12 authors. So we've got Tony was one of the first ones that we contacted. We've got Sally Rippon. A lot of these authors, they're children's authors, so the kids can actually really connect with them, find out, you know, what they've written and find out the styles that they write in. So there's Sally Rippon, Kirsty Murray, Michael Hyde, Claire Saxby, Paul Collins, Meredith Costain, Michael Wagner, Jane Godwin, Jackie Kerrin, Michael Pryor, and Alison Lloyd.
And
Tony Wilson.
How are the relationships between the other authors and the kids going?
All of the kids, they're exactly the same as adults. They've got, you know, their own personalities and they've got their own interests. And some of them are taking on the advice of the authors more than others, and which is also fantastic because they're all sort of finding their space and finding their voice. Some of them are taking their stories to a point where they're just firing ahead and there's a whole lot of action happening in a couple of lines, and others are sort of, you know, taking it a bit more slowly. We've got a whole range of genres that they're playing with. But all of them we've tried to match up in terms of their interests and the types of books that the authors write. So there's at least some sort of parallel.
But ours is the best of the fight stories.
and it was always going to be like that.
I was going to say, with all your research about matching people, where did this one go wrong? Where did Tones go wrong?
I think it's actually gone perfectly. All right. So, I've been involved in this class for a short period of time, so I've at least been able to get to know the kids, to a point. And we've been dealing with their teacher, the classroom teacher, who's obviously, she's had them all through the year. So we started as a second half of the year project, so the teacher really knows, what these kids are interested in. They've been able to choose as well, so we didn't match the author and child up, so to speak. It was more a pitch to them and said, these are the authors that are going to be involved in the program. Who wants to work with who? Tell us why. And go out and do some research. So the kids had to go out and do some reading and say, well, I really want to work with Tony
Brett
Wilson.
Brett Easton Ellis,
because I'm fascinated about the human condition. But it was more, want to work with Tony Wilson because I really want to write something that has a whole lot of action in it. I love footy, and so that was one of those.
Because I loved him in Zoolander.
I loved him in Zoolander.
With the idea, authors hate it when they get asked where they get their ideas from, but you guys had an internship with, would we call him the godfather of literacy programs?
He really is. I'll take it back a step. About 2 years ago, we went to the Melbourne Writers Festival. Actually, Jenna, my partner, went to the Melbourne Writers Festival and saw a talk by Dave Eggers. Being interviewed by Tony Wilson. And Dave, other than starting McSweeney's, which is a literacy journal, and they create beautiful books, he also started up a writing centre for kids in San Francisco called 826 Valencia. And 826 Valencia was really focused on providing tutoring for kids. They're set up in the Mission, which is in the Latino district of San Francisco. They have workshops where the kids come in and do all sorts of things, where they write a book in 2 hours. And they have a team of volunteers that they send out to schools. So they teachers, if they need one-on-one work with kids, they can say, 826, we need 10 tutors to come out here so we can work with groups of kids, and they can send them out to do that. And so Jen and I saw that talk. We contacted 826 because she's got a background in publishing, mine's in education, and we just thought it was a perfect melding of our two experiences and skills. And we'd been thinking of doing something to bring those two things together. So we contacted 826, did a 3-month internship over there, and were involved in all those activities. And that's really sort of been the what we're looking at developing in Australia. So something along those lines, where we can offer these sorts of programs, but from a centre where we can have the kids come in, we can have a team of volunteers, we can offer all these different sorts of programs. So Pigeons is something that we've developed ourselves, but it's sort of based on that model from San Francisco that Dave Eggers kind of created.
Now, obviously, this fight story you're working on, I mean, what if it turns out to be, something real good? I mean,
like the best thing I ever do.
Yeah, I mean, is this...
Well, how do I shut out the kid? Is that what you're asking? How do I close out the kids?
You actually might have another fight on your hands if you're trying to do
that. In the story.
See, this in itself is a good story idea, yeah.
We're not allowed to name names, but it could be like a Tony Wilson as told to the kids, so you can both take credit.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could be with Tony Wilson on the cover of the book.
But it's interesting that when a lot of children's authors do visits to schools, and often you might ask, have you guys got any good story ideas? And you get some amazing ones. Like there was one kid at one of the schools out Diamond Creek way who suggested a counting book with a spider that's got lice. So it's in the bath, getting a lice bath, and you count the relatives of the spider's legs as they all come in to wash the spider. And I was thinking, that's better than anything I've come up with for 6 months. Stealable.
Were you supportive with that one, or did you actually get involved in a feud on the day with that one as well?
No, I very encouraging of it, but wrote it in my scrapbook. I'll wait for the statute of limitations to expire and pump it out and claim full credit. No, I won't.
Well, it's you say you've got 12 now, but a year from now, how big can this thing get?
Well, I mean, it's something, it can get huge, hopefully, but we don't want it to get too big because there's a huge part of it that's involved with us and you know, a team of volunteers that are working with us in terms of mediating, you know, facilitating the whole process, working with the kids in the classroom as well, because we, you know, they're putting a whole lot of time into this and we want them to really work through that editing process. So it's something that we, you know, envisage staying at a grassroots level, but getting as big as we can handle it. So I'd love to have, at the moment, working with half a class. At the moment, we'd love to.
Now, we're trailing out Lachlan Carter to news. Can you tell us, you're going to sort of do a little publication of these at the end, but you've also got a function coming up, haven't you?
We've got a fundraiser at the Newtown Workers Club, which is on the corner of Brunswick and Gertrude Street in Fitzroy. That's going to be on October the 25th. It's a Sunday night. We're going to have a few bands. The Suitcase Royale are going to be doing some theatre. It's going to be fantastic fun.
Well, congratulations. A brilliant idea. Well done. And good luck with the story you're working on, Tony. Good
stuff. Number six coming up soon.
Thank you, Lachlan. Our news is next. And then in the next hour, Lockie Hume is here for a bit of a natter.
Tony Martin and Tony Wilson on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
That's right. It's our final hour here filling in for Derek Gill. I don't think we've broken the show, have we, Tony?
Nothing that Derek won't be able to fix. with just a little bit of, I'm not allowed to say the brand name of glue, but he'd just be able to whip it up.
Tony, the executives at SBS just rang me.
This is the voice of Sam Pang, if you've just joined us.
Host of a show that's currently on.
Yeah, so it's not live, is it?
No, it's not live.
Because I'm in it as well at this very moment.
Yes, that's right now.
Sam Pang is with us, and now it's time to welcome, one of my favourite actors, a man who you would have seen recently on the ABC's Hollow Men, playing the role of Murph, or you might have seen him on that show, Rush, holding an entire prison to ransom. Lockie Hume, thanks for joining us.
Where's the fake applause, Tony?
I know. I feel nude without my fake applause and booing from time to time. Yeah. That's always handy. What were you doing on that show, Rush? I came in sort of halfway through the episode.
I'll tell you exactly what I was doing. My computer hard drive had crashed.
Right. This is in the show?
No, in real life.
Oh, in real life.
And it was going to cost me $3,000. To get it fixed.
Right.
Because I didn't understand that you had to have, like, backup hard drives and things. I thought, because I've got an Apple MacBook and so on.
Yeah, I wouldn't mention that brand name, but
no,
sure.
No. Well,
it's
you
fictional.
Said Rush, so we're just going toe for toe, okay?
Well, what sort of Rush isn't a brand name?
It's a television program.
It's a television
program.
Are you
saying that because there are ads?
I was using a generic computer. In fact, I know we're not allowed to use that because on Hollow Men, we had to actually put post-it notes over the brand names of our computers. During the show. Anyway, my hard drive had crashed, and so I had to get this guy Simon in to fix it up for me, and he sent me a bill for $3,000 because apparently they had to take the hard drive to like a hermetically sealed vault to retrieve the data. I don't know.
Right.
You know, it's all very 2001 to me.
So Rush came to the rescue?
No. Well, basically, I rang my agent and I said, look, I don't want to put this on the credit card. What's coming up this week? And she said, well, there's an episode of Rush on it.
Okay,
and so there you go. And it was great fun to do. It's a great show.
You were sort of a super villain kind of a character.
Yeah, I was. I was Lex Luthor.
Lucky.
Very good.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, John Standish. In terms of your futuristic movie references, are you thinking of updating them to include ones that aren't now a past reference, in that 2001 is 8 years ago?
Yeah.
So when you say it's very 2001...
Well, it's very 2001 in the sense that the Stanley Kubrick film, when they actually get into the guts of HAL the computer, it looked like a hermetically sealed vault. And that is what I pictured my $3,000 going to, a bunch of guys floating gravitation-free in a red sealed vault.
I love futuristic things set in the past, like Space 1999.
Yeah.
No,
Planet of the Apes.
1984.
What is just as good is a little bit of honesty. You know, usually you talk to actors about why they took a role, and they go, "Well, I read the script and
I felt a kinship with the character,
and I've always wanted to work with that director."
I need some money to fix the computer.
<Thank you.
laughs> But that said, I did have a great time on Rush, and it's always very difficult if you're a guest actor on a show. You meet the regular cast and suddenly you're feeling like a bit of a fifth wheel and they've got their right. sort of lingo and the whole bit. Fortunately, I didn't have to interact with any of the cast members. So I had...
You were in prison.
Yeah, I had 3 days on set with just me and the crew. So yet again, my monstrous ego was sated by not having to look or feel as if it was anybody's show but my own.
Of course.
Which was great.
And how does your monstrous ego go on the set of Hollow Men?
Well, you're not allowed to have an ego on the Hollow Men.
No.
But you see, Hollow Men's unlike any other set to work on in the sense that, you know, you go on a show like Rush, you've got 60 crew and, you know, hundreds of extras and regular cast and the whole bit. With Hollow Men, because you're working with the Working Dog guys, it's just them.
Yeah.
They don't have... you know, an army of people working beneath them. For example, I'll give you an idea. If I'm doing a scene with Rob Sitch, and it's just Robbie and I in the scene, Rob is the director of the scene, okay? Yeah. Santo Chilaro is on camera, okay?
He's one of the characters as well.
He's also one of the characters, and his offside is Stefan Duschio is on the other camera. Robbie... Santo or Snato Garo, as we call him.
That's how his name is often misspelled.
Misspelled. Snato, Robbie, and Tom Gleisner are the writers, okay? Tom's upstairs writing the scripts. We're downstairs shooting the script he's just written with Rob and Snat. It's just us. The sound guys are in another room, and there's Annie Maver with the clapperboard, and that's it.
Yeah. So you're saying Working Dog's cheap. Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
Completely. Okay. According to my bank balance, they are. I can assure you of that. Apparently, they're raking it in. I'm certainly not.
Oh, hang on.
Hello. I happen to know they're on holiday at the moment, so none of them will
hear
this.
So they won't hear this just as well. Fine work. And the Hollow Men, I mean, it's one of those shows where, you know, is it going to come back? I mean...
I don't know.
I'm trying to remember what the ending was of the last episode. Was it a cliffhanger?
No. It wasn't really. We'd all love to come back and do it. The issue with a show like Hollow Men is there a story to tell.
Hmm.
I've talked with Rob and Tom and Snato about various things that they've got in mind for it, but really it's up in the air and it's up to them. And you know how secretive they are, Tone. You've worked with them a lot more than I have. So
it is very secretive. Yeah. They've got a secret base in a giant volcano.
That's true.
Somewhere. I don't know if you've been there.
No, I haven't. I haven't. I did get taken to the holiday home, which is in the North Pole. It's called the Fortress of Solitude and apparently requires a humongous key.
I thought you were going to say crystal, like in Superman 2.
No. Tone will tell you.
No, I remember when I was a kid, that was one of the big disappointments for me watching the Superman movie as a kid is, oh, he's going out the Fortress of Solitude. Where's the giant key?
Where's the giant key?
Because it literally had a giant keyhole and Superman had to carry an enormous key.
From under a giant doormat.
This is in the comic.
That's how Superman unlocks the Fortress of Solitude. But Mr. Wilson, I'm with you. I prefer the cinematic version where it's simply throwing a slender green crystal to grow the Fortress
of
Solitude.
And how lucky is he that in the destruction of his temple in Superman 2, that he sees that little glow in the snow. Without that seeing
very
that
fortunate
crystal, he wouldn't have been able to regrow his palace after he chose to be mortal.
Because who's it keeping out? I mean, who else is up? I mean, the giant...
Well, hang on. Zod tried to get in.
Oh, you're Zod. Sorry.
Luthor tried to get in.
The Brainiac would have had a crack at some point.
Brainiac absolutely would have.
Okay. You know?
Bizarro would have had a crack at it too, but on the South Pole side of things.
In the movie, they all got there, didn't they?
Yeah, because...
I think even his test marker just dropped in for a chat.
Test marker got there. It's because Luthor invented a device in prison to detect Superman's presence. Now, I don't know what technology would have been available to him at Leavenworth Penitentiary to do that.
But
somehow he did, and conspired with Miss Tessmacher to have a hot air balloon drop a rope ladder, which of course poor Otisberg got
Ned Beatty.
Yes.
Yeah, he did get left behind. He always got the short end of the stick, did Ned Beatty in the Superman film.
Well, anyway, welcome to the ABC.
Yes,
your
the
intellectual
ABC.
Discussions.
774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria with myself, Tony Martin, Tony Wilson, Sam Pang, and Lockie Hume. Let's have some music. This is interesting. Our producer, John Standish, has decided to get out the best of two-tone in our honour.
Beautiful.
And what can we play from that? What about the specials featuring Rico and a message to you, Rudy? That's the specials featuring Rico. A message to you, Rudy, from the best of two-tone. And you're listening to Two Tones, of course, Tony Wilson, Tony Martin, filling in for Derek Eel, who will be back on Monday, currently manning the conversation hour on 774. Sam Pang is with us, despite the fact that he's currently going to air on SBS.
As are you, Tony. You're on the show.
Extraordinary.
And Lockie Hume, actor Lockie Hume, you know him from the ABC's Holloman. You may have seen him in the Matrix trilogy.
Yeah, or not. Hey, where's the applause coming up again?
How badly do you want applause?
I'm just so used to it. Whenever I'm doing radio, Mr.
Martin.
Hey,
yeah, I do.
Thank you. Very happy to be here. Welcome to the ABC.
It's meant to be a sort of more adult style of broadcast that I'm used to, so I haven't brought all of my sound effects with me.
He does crave the audience interaction.
No, it's the fake audience interaction. It's so much more appealing. There's no laugh track on Holloman.
You've had real audience, though, haven't you? Haven't you had a season up in Sydney working at the STC?
At the Sydney Theatre Company.
Wow.
Cate Blanchett. And Andrew Upton's Sydney Theatre Company.
Nice. And was this Elling?
Elling was the show, yes. And it's got a little bit of an interesting genealogy. It was a series of Norwegian books about a guy called Elling who is a dysfunctional fellow who gets committed to a mental asylum where he meets my character, Kjell Bjarne, and the two of them get released back into society and given a government-subsidised flat to see if they can fit back in, dot, 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 hilarity and shoes.
Right.
But though it was four books, and then that was adapted into a play in Norway, which was then adapted into a feature film in Norway, which was nominated for Best Foreign Film at the Oscars.
Oh.
And then that was in turn adapted into an English language version for the West End, and then that's the production that we've taken to Sydney.
And when you say we, who was playing the other character?
Darren Gilshannon.
Now, he's got quite a reputation. In the theatre. How was he to work with?
Wonderful. Just, you know, he's probably the best comedic actor in Australia. He's on another ABC veteran because he's in Shandon Pictures.
Yes.
Rob Carlton's show. He plays Nick the cameraman.
And
Daz is awesome and he's brilliant. He was perfectly cast.
What's his reputation to?
You were just trying to be controversial.
He does have he was in a Shakespeare production a few years ago.
He's done
a
lot of Shakespeare.
I didn't mean like a reputation Oliver Reed style.
No,
I just meant for
that's
being
my reputation.
Yes, for being a scene stealer and a very funny man. But who was the director? Was that Pamela
Rabe?
Now, has she directed before?
I think Pam had done one thing before, but this was sort of her major production for the STC. So I tell everybody that's her first play because it makes me sound better than I was cast in her first play as director.
Now, we've asked all the sensible ABC questions, but there's a bit of Who Weekly running through my veins. Mm-hmm. I need to ask, did you meet Cate Blanchett?
I did.
Yes?
I did meet Cate. She came on the second to last night of the season in Sydney before we went on tour because she'd been in Sherwood Forest doing Robin Hood with Russ Crowe. I won't reveal anything that Cate may have mentioned about that particular production, but anyway, she showed up. I had injured myself quite badly during the last sort of 10 days of the show because during the course of the show, apart from sort of physical stunts and stuff I had to do, I had to physically lift every member of the cast at some point during the show.
All right. And you did this for 6 months?
Yes.
Okay.
And just lifting the warm props, as I call them.
Torval and Dean style.
Yeah, a little bit of that. And I'd separated the muscles in between my ribs, which apparently I didn't know I had muscles between my ribs, but apparently we all do. And so I was in a bit of pain. And we all knew Cate had come to see the show that night, and everybody was a bit nervous about that, A, because she's the boss of the company, but B, because she's Cate Blanchett, Academy Award-winning movie star. And I was backstage. Everybody else, all the cast got changed very quickly after the show to rush out to have a drink and wait for her after. I was still limping into my street clothes and having a sook about this to one of the other STC crew members, and Cate walked in. And she went, oh, hi, Lockie, I'm Cate. And I went, I said, listen, you're the boss. I'm in a lot of pain. We've got to start organising a chiropractor. And I just started unloading.
Start making demands.
Okay, you know, like in a hostage situation type thing. And Anyway, we had a chat for a while, and then, you know, she sort of gave me a little bit of a squeeze around the shoulders, a bit of a back rub, and she said, look, I've got a bottle of vodka in my desk. Let me go get that, and we can have a drink and calm you down a little bit. And that's how I met Kate Blanchett. And, yeah, she is the real deal. And I think the thing that we all took away from it, those of us in the cast, is having spent a bit of a boozy evening with her, because she literally just got off the plane from the UK that day. She's just a working actress. That's what she does. You know, she's just a jobbing actress, and her primary responsibility outside of her family is running the Sydney Theatre Company, which her and her husband Andrew, who I'd gotten to know Andrew very well over the course of the run, but they plan, as far as I can see, about running that theatre company for a very, very long time.
You know, and she's given you a message.
Massage is probably overstating the case. Yeah. Well, I like to think that she gave me a vodka. And I think that's far more impressive.
On a completely different matter, a friend of mine works at an office block in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And the other day, the word went round that they could go upstairs to the next floor and get a free massage from a medical insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, is this how medical insurance companies have to get people to sign on now, by having free massages in your workplace?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, right, well, how did you know that it was... Like, how was it set up? Were the logos everywhere? Was it genuinely affiliated with a medical insurance company? And she said, oh, there was an Olympian there. Well, some sort of Olympian athlete was there, sort of just standing there.
Endorsing
it.
What do you mean, standing at the front of a massage parlor?
And I said, break it down for me. Who was there? There was the masseur, there was a person in a white coat from the medical insurance company, and there was an Olympian athlete. And I said, how did you know that this was going on? And she said, oh, the Olympic athlete was just going through the building from cubicle to cubicle saying, do you want to get a massage on the next floor?
Who was the... First of all, was the Olympic athlete Stephanie Rice?
Do you not know the name of the Olympian? Well, it's not Dick Quacks, is it?
Let's just say that it was Dick Quacks, because I don't want to cause any legal trouble.
There was actually an Olympian called Dick Wax.
Silver medalist, Lockie.
Not Dick Wax. That would be ridiculous. Yeah. Dick Quacks.
Oh, Dick Quacks.
He went to Tony's school.
He's the most famous man to have gone to my school. Silver medalist in the 5,000 metres in 1976 at Montreal.
Nice work, Tone.
But imagine if you're just working in your cubicle suddenly Dick Quacks leans over and goes, do you want a massage? Just pop upstairs.
If
you've got a guy called Dick Quacks leaning over, it's a massage you want. You don't want anything beyond that. Do you went to Hamilton Boys High?
Yeah, that's right. There were no girls, correct.
Okay.
That sounds so much.
That sounds very similar to like old boxers, Tone, that have to stand out the front of a casino and their job is to meet and greet.
Yeah.
Like it's very...
Jake LaMotta.
It's Jerry Cooney who stand out the front and say, oh, welcome, have a great time. That's all they do.
You are on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. The text number is 1974774. And what the hell is this? Geek Hour, someone has
that was after our Superman discussion earlier.
We're just getting warmed up on that, by the way. That was round one on the Superman discussion.
So the two Tonys, if you release recordings of this show, you should call them Tony and Tony, the Shambolic Sessions.
I don't know if that's actually a comment on our presentation style or the fact that I was saying that shambolic is my favourite word yesterday's show.
It's on the presentation.
It's the presentation. What about Beck? She says, Tony and Tony, your show has been a joy. Thank you. We'll miss you. And then a few minutes later, we've changed our mind because you haven't read out our text. Sorry about that, Beck. They can turn very quickly, this audience. Lockie Hume is with us, with myself, Tony Martin, Tony Wilson, and Sam Pang. And Lockie, this play we've been talking about, Elling, you've toured it around for 6 months. It feels to me like you've been everywhere except Melbourne.
Didn't come to Melbourne. When we were doing the show in Sydney, the Queensland Theatre Company made an offer for us to go there, but they'd only do it if the Melbourne Theatre Company would co-sponsor the tour, but it turned out to be too pricey, apparently. And that's not because of my salary or anything, my computer issues. It takes a lot to put a show like this on the road. So as far as I know, that's it for Elling, which is a pity for those who wanted to see it, but joyous for me because I was sick to the back teeth of doing it by the last sort of 2 weeks. I think I was ready to jump off a cliff.
I was doing some stand-up comedy a few years ago at the Star and Garter down in South
Melbourne. Love that pub. a great pub. Are we allowed to name it? Is that against the ABC rules?
Is it okay to name the pub but not say if you have an opinion on whether the pub is any good? Guests can say they love it, presenters can't.
Okay.
Thank you, John.
Official rules?
I was just mentioning it as a comedy venue. I wasn't mentioning it as a promotion. But what I was going to say is at that time you were upstairs, I think, in David Mamet's...
No, we were rehearsing upstairs in David Mamet's Sexual Perversity in Chicago. So we're going back a long time. This is about 1991.
And were you, because the movie of that people will know as About Last Night.
About Last Night, dot, dot, dot.
Were you the Jim Belushi character?
I was.
You were the Belushi.
I played the Belushi character, Bernie Litkow. And can I segue, because Mr. Sam Pang has a book here called Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live. I've read this book. In fact, I was stacking it in my bookshelf today because I'm currently moving house.
How much does everyone, they love Chevy Chase? They love him.
Oh, yeah, he's a popular guy, isn't he? But I'll tell you what, you mentioned Belushi, Tone.
Yes.
Virtually every single page of this book, somebody mentions John Belushi. People who didn't meet him, never knew the whole bit. But the legacy of this guy is extraordinary. He's Tom Hanks waxing.
But very few people mentioning Jim Belushi, who was actually in the cast.
He was for one year. 84, 85 seasons.
Like I say, Tony Martin, Tony Wilson, Sam Pang, and Lockie Hume. Not enough people in here. Tony Delroy, what is happening on the nightlife after 10?
Well, a good plan. Yes, look, we're talking motoring. Young Hagen is going to bound through the door just after 10. Let's have a little chat about Formula One tonight, because obviously the Renault decision this week still leaves a bit of a nasty taste. The fact that one of the bosses of Renault told Nelson Piquet to crash the car during a Grand Prix race does tend to think, is this the way sport should be run?
Maybe it should be. Maybe we haven't thought this through.
Well, perhaps, sort of like motorsport action of bygone eras, you know, where they crash and bash. I think that maybe that would be the new future for Formula
maybe
One.
Maybe chicks on roller skates would be a cool contribution. I don't know. Tony, don't worry, Gary Neal is back on Monday.
Do not panic.
Yes. Anything involving roller skates, the Gold Coast is interested.
What else is on the nightlife?
We're planning to talk about things that are happening at the Frankfurt Motor Show and a few other new release cars as well. So anything to do with four and two wheel, Mr. Hagen has got it covered pretty well. Mark Willsey is going to join me from Tokyo tonight. We're going to talk, in fact, until about 3 minutes ago, I didn't know the new Prime Minister was called Yukio Hatoyama.
I could have told you that.
Oh, thanks. Now you tell me. He was elected, of course, on a wave of voter disgust with the long-ruling Liberal Democratic Party that had been there since the dawn of time. So we're going to have a look at exactly what's happened. What is the New Look Japan all about?
Is Mark Willsey one of the Willsey dynasty?
No.
He's not related to, I think there was Mike Willsey, Terry, Don, and Zeppo Willsey, as we know.
Do you think this guy changed his name to Willsey in order to be confused
just
with
to,
the Willsey
or just
dynasty?
To get a bit of that cachet?
I've got to say, it certainly hasn't hurt in the past, so I'm sure he's smiling ear to ear. A lot of the Willseys actually did start at the ABC.
That's right.
Mike sort of got his... cut his teeth on four corners and the like. So yeah,
Tony, have you ever had a promo for your show that's actually taken right up till 10 o'clock? Have you ever done that?
Do you want to try?
Let's go. Go for gold.
I just want to hear you say Tokyo again.
Tokyo.
Very nice.
Just briefly, I'm going to talk to Evan McHugh tonight. He's just written a new book about a year in Birdsville. It's a bit like the year in Provence that Peter Mayol did, and then about 10 other replicas of, getting away from the thrill of the city and finding that little country estate that you do up.
Yes.
But this guy's moved to Birdsville for a year. And
it's not exactly the south of France, is it?
He did notice a couple of differences. The grapes, not quite as good. Anyway, we'll have a chat to him about his Discovery of the Outback. All that and a fair bit more, and we'll rock and roll after 10.
Excellent, Tony. Can I just quickly ask, how did you go last night with the discussion about the Liberace biography or biopic?
Well, after your revelation, it did sort of lack a little bit of punch.
Sorry,
you know, the Soderbergh film with Michael Douglas.
Is it Soderbergh or is it Stone?
Soderbergh's directing it. Mike Douglas is playing Liberace, and Matt Damon's Scott Glover. Thorson.
Sorry to have...
It's been in the works for like 5 years.
Sorry to have cut your lunch there.
Well, although it's actually in production at this stage, and that's the reason we were mentioning it, because Steven Soderbergh came out and said, look, Michael Douglas is actually going very well. I was a little bit nervous about it at the beginning, but he's showing some brilliant signs, and it's going to be a good flick.
That's the reason we were talking about. Certainly look forward to the trailer for that one. Thank you, Tony. All the best on the Nightlife After 10. And thanks for putting up with our idiotic interjections over the last fortnight.
Mm. And that's just including the last promo.
Is that the first time that Tony's been heckled during his promo? I could have told you that.
Come on. Derek gets a bit under the weather and all sorts of things happen.
I think he's got his facts wrong for a start. First of all, they haven't shot a frame on the Liberace film. Michael Douglas is in New York shooting Money Never Sleeps, the sequel to Wall Street, and Steven Soderbergh's at the Sydney Theatre Company at the moment directing a play.
Wow.
How is Liberace being shot at the moment? And Matt Damon's promoting The Informant, Soderbergh's previous.
You should really stick around for Tony.
If I can echo the sentiments of the SMS earlier, is this the geek hour? I think it is. Let's have some music. Here's Dave Graney. Now, I should point out a slight language warning. It's after 9:30, so I think we can handle the BS word. It's not gratuitous. This is a song that I always put on when I want to think about what it's like heading back to my own family reunion. Dave Graney, Don't Mess With The Blood. That's Dave Graney, the Dave Graney Show, to be precise, from the album Heroic Blues. Don't Mess With The Blood. Tony Martin and Tony Wilson, our final night filling in for Derek Gill here on 774 Melbourne and ABC Victoria. Sam Pang has been sitting in the sidecar for some time.
I can go anytime you want.
No, you're sticking around. We may need some Don Rickles information before we sign off. Lockie Hume is here, actor Lockie Hume from The Hollow Men, amongst other things, just telling us he's had some sort of major surgery today.
I had a root canal today, and I said to him before they started pumping my head full of drugs,
yeah,
I'm meant to be doing a radio show on the ABC tonight, so let's really OD on this stuff so I can get through it.
Did they give you the good gear?
It was awesome. And I'll tip it, you know, like this was the second part of a root canal. The first time you get it done is when you're in abject pain and they get it done really quickly.
Right.
But this is the one you go back for later where they clean out the guts of that tooth. And it's like an hour of getting punched in the head.
Do you know, my dentist, and this will, I'm sure that many youngsters in the eastern suburbs had the same experience, but my dentist was called Dr. Blood.
Really?
What? Yes.
Really? And did he have a logo to match that?
Not only that, because it's a football fan, it's a football weekend, Michael Blood, Cappy was his nickname, both as a footballer and a dentist. He played for Hawthorn as well.
Oh, fantastic. Interesting. You shouldn't mention any of this to Tony Martin because Tony Martin doesn't even know what football code you're discussing at the moment. Right? Is that a fair call, Tony?
I've seen the blankness, and the blankness is descending. Over the weekend, he's about to go into
Ask him what he's doing for the grand final. What are you doing for the grand
final? Every year,
Tony?
I go to a movie on when the grand final's happening.
What are you planning on seeing this year, mate?
I want to see Up, actually. I've heard that's really good.
It's a Pixar film.
And what I do is you go on grand final day, you will get the cinema to yourself pretty much every time. I had that...
Howard Hughes-like.
Yeah, you can pretend to be Howard Hughes. Grow your hair really long, fingernails.
Put a Kleenex box on your head and...
Crash a plane and off you shoot. And what you do is you just sit there, you can heckle the screen, you find even the most popular film, you'll often get the entire cinema to yourself.
What did you see last year?
I can't remember because what happened was I had a 5-year run where it was just two of us in the cinema, had the whole cinema to ourselves, and then on the 6th year... There was one other person in the cinema and it wasn't the same.
And he sat right next to you, didn't he?
Did.
We are so different. That is my special time of the year.
Look how offended you look.
You know how you rattle off like an IMDb every stat of every movie ever? Ask me grand finalist, Brownlow medalist and Norm Smith medalist any year.
Norm Smith medalist 1985.
Norm Smith medalist was Essendon versus Hawthorn, Simon Madden.
Best ruck performance ever in the history
margin,
of football.
Margin, 85 points.
Mm-hmm. Right.
An absolute shellacking.
Brownlow medal, Brad Hardy.
I didn't ask, you're showing off.
Drinks this consumed?
This is good for you to even actually get the question right, Tone. Yeah. Ask him something else.
The Norm Smith Brownlow Grand Final medal for 1991.
Norm Smith, Paul Deer, who's presenting it this weekend. Brownlow was Jim Steins, yep. Get Well Jim, and Premier was Hawthorne over West Coast with Angry Anderson in the Batmobile.
It was the only grand final that wasn't played at the MCG. It was out at Waverley.
Yep.
And with Angry screaming around singing Bound for Glory, I had a mate over from the States and I just remember shriveling into the size of a snail.
How did he feel about the Batmobile being used?
Americans are used to their halftime entertainment for, you know, on the Super Bowl, where they'll have the Beatles play with the Rolling Stones as the support act, and we've got Angry
in a Batmobile coming out to Bound for Glory.
It wasn't even a Batmobile. It was a crappy old half-shaved Lincoln Continental with some blue fins, cardboard fins slapped on the side.
I wonder if you shriveled though to the extent that Sugar Ray Leonard was giggling away at what he was seeing. Sugar Ray Leonard was there as a guest.
Yes,
and he could not believe what he was seeing. Wait, there is a bald man singing in a souped
up. Just driving around in a paddock.
I think it's actually one of the high points in the history of grand final entertainment because it's memorable, it's iconic, it didn't try too hard. Yeah. Whereas when you put Jet in the middle of MCG with no audience around it, no atmosphere, just some really loud decibelage and some songs that most of the people are trying to concentrate on talking about the footy and it's kind of interrupting that. That is more awkward than something that is a real talking point, gets the crowd laughing.
Yeah, you're right. But, all right, Mr. Wilson, outside of that, on the one extreme, Angry Anderson on the other, what is a nice, memorable MCG grand final halftime pre-show entertainment moment, in your opinion?
There is no middle ground, is there, Tom?
That's not cringeworthy.
I love the sprint. The sprint works really well. And, in fact, I'd like to expand the sprint. At the moment, they have players from each club just running up. Everyone remembers Jeff Ablett dominated the sprint for about 5 years in the early 80s. But what I think they should do is, I saw it on pay TV recently, like the sheepdog trials. You get the dogs out. You dress them in the team colours. Mm-hmm. You have the little tunnels. You have the jumps. You have the dressage element, the crowd would go absolutely crazy.
Who doesn't like dog tricks?
Okay. That is pretty much the highest. New Zealand listeners will know that I am not joking when I mention the words "Tux Wonder Dogs," which is basically it's a knockout performed by dogs, and it's the highest rating show on television. It is amazing to me that it's not been done here because everyone laughs. They go, "Who would want to watch that?" And yet, when you see it, it is the most compelling television you have ever seen.
You to the grand final time.
I would go if the Tux Wonder Dogs on the obstacle course were performing. I'd probably pop down there. SMSs are coming in. Listen to this. Somebody says, "Hi, I had Dick Quax's sister Rosemary in my class at Berkeley Intermediate in Hamilton in New Zealand, and I worked in radio also." That's Ross from Hamilton. Too strange, he says. We have got a great track. This is one John Standish, our producer, has been trying to squeeze in for the last fortnight. This is a corker. Turn your radio up for this one. DJ Fairoff with his mashup of John Lennon and Bob Marley, Let It Be. Well, sorry, it should really be Paul McCartney, shouldn't it? Let It Be, No Cry. That's DJ Fairoff with, or Fairoff if you prefer, Let It Be, No Cry. Bit of a mashup there here on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. Tony Martin and Tony Wilson sitting in the gheel-shaped chairs for the final time. Sam Pang in the sidecar and Lockie Hume struggling with his headphones.
What is this? What did somebody tie this up when I wasn't looking? Somebody has knotted the cord on my headset and it's making me a fool that every... Hang on, they can't see me.
Right. They can't. Halftime entertainment of the football, that got me quite interested in football, that discussion, Tony.
Because really it's about entertainment. It could end up on IMDb, the halftime entertainment, if someone filmed it.
Hang on, what's going on? Wait a minute. Oh, it's the Wonder Dogs. See, that's the kind of entertainment. We want to see down there at half time.
I believe the Best in Show is going on. I heard this on 774 this afternoon. But the big day at the show is, was it tomorrow? I think tomorrow is the finals of the Dogs.
Oh, the Labs are always good value.
I saw today in the paper that today at the show they had the Rats and Mysex.
Show bag?
Yeah, right. I'm guessing it was something in the grain feed store. I don't know what it was, but I just saw the little thing. Coming down and see the Rats and Mice today.
Rats and Mice get a lot of bad press. But if you want to start warming to Rats and Mice, apart from Stuart Little...
Halftime entertainment.
Read one of my favourite books for, I reckon the age group would be about 10 to 14.
Yeah.
Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. It's a magnificent
book. It's a real book?
It's a real book, and it's
won the Pulitzer, didn't it?
Mrs. Frisbee's...
For biography?
Mrs. Frisbee needs to move house because the plough is going to go through her burrow.
Oh, I hate that.
And she seeks help from the Rats of Nim.
Well, hang on, don't ruin it for us.
And it turns out there's a special connection between the Frisbee family, the mice, and the Rats of Nim.
Okay.
Okay.
Covers everything.
Hang on, is this like the Nim spelled N-I-M-H?
Because you remember the movie
The Secret of Nim, which Spielberg produced, if memory serves.
It is a fantastic book. It's probably a 50 years old, the Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim.
Hmm. Okay, well, one to put on the list.
Yeah.
One, hopefully, that won't be decimated by parallel importation. Let's just find out what's going on in the world of weather. Scott Williams, duty forecaster at the Bureau. What can you tell us?
And make it good.
Just ignore that man, Scott.
It's a doozy, Tony.
Don't be put off. You four, John.
Yeah. Battle on. Come on, Scotty. Let's hear it.
All right. Well, there's not much rain happening right now. There are a few showers in the east of the state, but there's a front on the way, and it's strengthening as it comes across. It'll enter Western Victoria tomorrow morning and spread through the state, so it'll probably be raining in the central district and Melbourne around the time the parade's on at lunchtime. It's not looking good there. And there'll be pretty heavy rain out of it as it gets into the northeastern highlands tomorrow afternoon and night, and sort of showers and colder air to follow. With that colder air, we've got a farmer's weather warning out for the Wimmera and Western District. It'll impact on there tomorrow. That'll spread further east Saturday. We've also got a severe weather warning for damaging wind gusts in higher parts of all of southern and mountain Victoria. Gusts up to 90 to 100 k's per hour tomorrow. Strong wind warning for the bays and the Gippsland lakes. So a pretty windy, wet and getting colder type day. The grand final day, unfortunately, it doesn't improve much. The front deepens into a whopper of a low just east of Tassie. And as it does so, that cold southwesterly will redevelop. So that early in the day in Melbourne, we'll probably have west to northwest winds and not too many showers around before lunchtime. But I think in the afternoon, the winds will tend around and it's unstable. So the little bit of sun we do get, just heat the ground up and brew up some heavy showers, even the risk of hail and thunder around Saturday afternoon. So
I'm excited
not looking
by that.
Too good. 15 the top. No, you're excited.
I am excited.
A lot of people are excited by that, not football. You know?
I love the wet grand finals, of course. 71, a wet grand final. 79, a wet grand final.
You reckon that's going to tip it in Geelong's favour?
One of them I remember. I remember them both, but only just 71.
Scott, don't lie about your age, Scott, for a start.
Scott, were you listening to the quiz earlier on?
No, I missed that. Why?
I was going to get you to try to spell Bay Marie.
No, thanks. I won't try.
It's harder than it looks or sounds.
So after the wet grand final day and cold and with showers right throughout the state, the next day, the Sunday, we'll have a screaming gale. We'll have storm force winds through Bass Strait. We'll have very heavy rainfall into South Gippsland and Melbourne's catchments. So I think by Monday, over the 4 days, we're likely to get up to 100 millimetres of rain in the catchment. So that'll help us quite substantially in the coming weeks. But of course, it'll be a bleak day with widespread showers and only 14 in Melbourne. Showers not quite so frequent as far north as Mildura, but there'll still be a few even right up in there. And then I think the weather will clear slowly through Monday and Tuesday. It looks like being pretty much fine across the state. So, it was a doozy of a forecast for the weekend.
Plenty
and,
happening.
And listen, let me ask you something, Scott. Since you've actually predicted all the weather till next Tuesday, does that mean you don't have to go back on air until Tuesday night?
I go back on air Monday night, so preparation for getting that forecast.
I just want to know your MO, pal, since we've just met.
I'm willing to take any flack on what goes wrong.
No, so it's like the format of Perfect Match, where you set it up and then it was like how the date went is your Monday effort.
All right.
That's right.
Thank you very much, Scott. Thanks, everybody down at the Bureau, for putting up with our comments over the last 2 weeks. It's almost time, and because it's almost time, we're going to have a track from one of our favourites, Tony, Tom Waits, and my favourite Tom Waits album, Rain Dogs. Let's have Time. That's Tom Waits' Time from the album Rain Dogs, his Invisible Fiancés in the Mirror. It's almost time for us to sign off, Tony Martin and Tony Wilson. We've been honoured, I think, to be sitting in the gill-shaped chairs for the last 2 weeks. Thanks to everybody who's helped us out, John Standish, Paul, and the various button pushers who have been steering us in the right direction for the last fortnight. Sam Pang, thank you for sitting in. For this program. You're not sure why you've done it, but no, you have done it.
It's great.
You should have been at home watching yourself on telly, Sam.
I was nervous, but it turned out all right. You know, we rang me 5 minutes before the show started and said, can you come in? And I was honoured, and thank you so much, Tan.
Lockie Hume, thanks for sitting. Tom Waits, you've had lunch with Tom Waits, were saying.
When I was in San Francisco doing the Matrix sequels, Lawrence Fishburne, who obviously plays Morpheus in the film.
Sure.
Tom Waits is like his best mate.
Right.
And so there I was very excitedly sitting next to Fishburne in the actors area having our lunch, and suddenly I look up and Tom Waits is sitting directly opposite me, just sort of strolled onto set to see Fishburne. So, yes, that's how I met him. I can't remember a thing that was said.
Can't remember anything he said?
No, I mean, you know, I remember my knuckles being quite white during it all. I was terrified. It's terrifying when you meet icons like that. You don't remember anything.
Much like you would be if you met Dick Quacks, Tony.
Exactly, Tony.
Dick Quacks. Thanks to everyone who SMS'd in with a Dick Quacks fact. anyone else
there's
we should
segment.
Be thanking, Tony?
Oh, I thank you for having me along in this fortnight. I very much enjoyed being a part of it. And I hope we can do it again sometime.
And it feels to me like we should be ending on some note of portent about the grand final.
I just wish we had Angry Anderson singing Bound for Glory to hear us out.
In a Batmobile. That would be fantastic.
Well, Tone, who's your tip? St Kilda are playing Geelong.
I'll go for the one that's the best.
Sam, who's your tip?
I don't know.
Geelong.
Geelong by
6 goals.
Geelong by 6 points for me, and
Geelong by 3 goals.
Carna Bombers.
All right, Tony Delroy is next with the nightlife. That's after the news here on 774. Thanks, everybody.